Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Audio bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by the new WinApp for Android, featuring wireless sync and one-click iTunes import. Now with free daily music downloads and full-length CD listening parties. Download it for free at winamp.com/android. Video bandwidth for TWiT is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 386, released December 30th, 2012. The best of 2012. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Ford, featuring Bliss, the blind spot information system with cross-traffic alert, active park assist, and more. Check out these available features on the 2013 Ford Fusion and 2013 Ford Taurus, or learn more at ford.com/technology. And by Carbonite Online Backup. Automatic, continuous, unlimited backup for your computer files. Just $59 a year. Try it free at carbonite.com. And use the offer code TWIT to get 2 bonus months with purchase. And by Lantronics, makers of the XPrint server. Print from your iPad, iPhone, or any iOS device to virtually any printer. For more information, visit xprintserver.com/TWIT. And enter the code TWIT to receive 20% off your order. And by Audible.com. To download 2 free audiobooks of your choice, visit audible.com/TWIT2. And don't forget to follow audible_com on Twitter. And get a copy of Brandon Sanderson's Legion absolutely free, our gift to you at audible.com/Sanderson. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a special episode of This Week in Tech. I hope you enjoyed last week's holiday special with John Hodgman, Jonathan Colton, Paul and Storm, and that strange Roderick fellow who showed up. This one's going to be a little different. This is our yearly best of. We'd like to end the year with a look back at some of the great stories of 2012, and we've got a bunch of them for you. We're going to kick off with one of the stories that happened early in the year that was a bit of a shocker and gave rise to a new monetary unit on the internet, one Instagram. Watch as we talk about Facebook purchasing Instagram for $1 billion. Let's start, because the big story, and I apologize for people who listen to all our shows, because this story broke Monday, the day after last week's TWiT. So we've gone full, if you listen to all our shows, we've gone through every show now to talk about this story, but we haven't done it yet on TWiT, and we need to, and I've got a great panel to talk about it. Instagram selling to Facebook. This company's 15 months old, 12 employees. They are an iOS app, recently released an Android app. Boy, we couldn't have a better panel here to talk about it. We've got one of the great photographers here, $1 billion.
Now, you're not going to preoccupy yourself with the price, with the money that's floating around, because you did that on the show, on the radio.
Hard not to.
But I mean, you were like,
if it were $999 million, it wouldn't be the same story.
You said that exact same thing. It's a nice round number.
But don't you think it's a materialistic analysis, and we should be looking at the possible reasons that they did this rather than
anything with $1 billion in it is materialistic. I don't care what. All right. According to The Verge, Dante Orazio writing, it took Mark Zuckerberg 2 days to make this deal. You think it was a rush to judgment?
No, I don't think he wanted anyone else to start a bidding war. I think they just...
Is that what it was, defensive?
Yeah, no, I can't believe there would be a bidding
war. New York Times said...
I believe it was defensive, but I don't believe there would be a bidding war.
Not at that price.
The company, whole story is just so ridiculous. The
company had just been valued at $500 million a couple months ago.
Also ridiculous. It's a picture-sharing mobile app.
It's an app.
That's all it
is. It's not even a website.
It's not anything. Yes, it has a lot of users, but...
But every one of those users, Jolie, doesn't every one of those users probably a Facebook member already? I mean, doesn't Facebook know more about them?
Which gives it away.
Now, here's what it is. In the IPO filing documents, everybody was saying, oh, you know, mobile is Facebook's biggest weakness when you're talking about investors and publicly traded Facebook stock. So this is Facebook saying, hey, no, we can do mobile. Look, we bought a big mobile company for $1 billion. Isn't that competent of us? And maybe it is. Sure, I'm not privy to those discussions, but it's so bubbly. I talked to people who lived...
Bubbly in the sense of like a stock bubble. Like
I talked with people who went through the 90s dot-com bust, and they said...
You were 12 at the time, so
no,
you probably don't remember it.
Darlin, I was working in my first computer
job.
Were you already? Yeah, I was. I had my first startup job in 1999.
So you lived through this, actually.
I am older than I look.
Yes.
So no, but everyone who is from that era is saying, okay, this is the kind of deal that makes people terrified that our whole internet economy is going to collapse again.
It's overheated.
Oh, God, it's ridiculous. $1 billion.
No, wait a minute. I think with the brains at this table, we could figure out why.
I had a good column in MarketWatch about this.
Why did this happen?
Because because the number of users, like I think you said on your other show,
30 million,
are all Facebook users already, and
right.
They were ripe for the plucking. Google could have grabbed them all and picked up 33 million people right off the top, and Facebook is starting to exhibit the Microsoft paranoia qualities, and I think this is one evidence of it. They are getting and Google's showing this too. They're paranoid about the things going on around them because, they're making so much money they can't even consider the possibility that that competition might be good for them. So they did a defensive move, grabbed this thing out of sheer paranoia, and far as I'm concerned, pulled a Yahoo. This is the broadcast.com.
This is broadcast.com, exactly.
It's a broadcast.com.
How long before Kevin Systrom, the CEO of Instagram, buys the Portland Trail Blazers and runs onto the court throwing chairs? It's a matter of months.
They have to buy them from Paul Allen, who won't sell them, but they could buy the Seattle team, which has moved to, or they could create a new Seattle team because the other team's moved to Oklahoma City.
There you go.
Taking the devil's advocate side, it's really easy to look at this and say, obviously they overpaid. I mean, $1 billion for a couple of filters and a few users that Facebook probably already has seems like a lot of money. But this is a particularly vulnerable time for Facebook. They are in IPO land now, and they don't want any competition when the IPO finally hits. They don't want any questions about whether or not they are the number one mobile space.
Well, is it really competition when all of the Instagram photos get pushed to Facebook and Facebook is the one that monetizes those?
It would be if Twitter or Google Plus bought them and flipped that little switch there.
But didn't Twitter just buy a photo sharing?
Well, certainly Twitter couldn't afford $1 billion.
They didn't buy TwitPic. Which one did they buy?
I don't know.
Anyhow, Twitter bought one.
Don't know.
Facebook bought one. I'm going to go buy one. It doesn't even matter. So
according to the Times, Mr. Zuckerberg, that's how you know it's the Times, Mr.
Zuckerberg,
placed a call on Friday, last Friday, a week ago, to Kevin Systrom, the CEO and founder of Instagram, and a very nice guy. We interviewed him when Instagram came out, and he was still one of us. According to people with knowledge of the matter, who spoke on condition of anonymity because the discussions were private, Mr. Zuckerberg was blunt, they said. If Facebook wanted to buy Instagram over the next 48 hours, Facebook and Instagram hammered out the details for a $1 billion cash and stock deal. Well, I can imagine that call. Hi, Kevin. It's Mark. Mark Zuckerberg. Mark Zuckerberg, yeah. Hey, I want to buy you. And Kevin thinks, I don't want to sell. Sure, Mark. It'll be $1 billion. Okay, where do I send the check? you can't turn down $1 billion.
Maybe you thought you said a million.
1 million. I think that's what happened. I think Kevin said, yeah, sure, $1 billion. And Mark said, he didn't blink. Yeah, sure.
Well, here's a vector.
Could have gone for 1.5.
Here's something that no one's really talking about. And I think something's happening right in front of us, right underneath us, and no one really understands it. But I think the way humans are starting to communicate with each other is evolving.
It's going to visual, isn't it?
It's becoming a picture-sharing society.
Right.
For years, ever since Gutenberg, right, at the printing press, we've been converting concepts into words and paragraphs, and that's how we've communicated. In fact, that's how we've communicated on the web forever. But if things continue at their current rate and we're sharing more and more photos, you can communicate concepts and stories and ideas with photos almost as effectively as words. It's not better or worse than words. It's just different.
It's faster. It's easier.
And it's more mobile friendly. And I think that's
very
hugely
much
important.
So.
Hugely important, yeah.
In fact, as you say that, Trey, I think about my use. I use Path and Instagram. And I most often will send a picture and maybe a few words.
And look, most everybody now, if you have a streaming type life, right, you just flip through the words until you see a picture that's interesting, and then you might read some words around it.
Right.
Instagram is a pure photo sharing thing. And if you think about, like, humans, as we develop, basically from age 3 till 10, you're learning this alphanumeric system and how to convert concepts into cogent sentences. That is a huge amount of human development time. But what if people just start sharing photos, to share stories of their life, to share concepts?
Actually, Pinterest exploits this thought.
In fact,
it's like going backwards a little bit to cuneiform, if you ask.
You got to think Pinterest is probably next on the block, right? How much is Pinterest worth if this is worth $1 billion? This is the popular page right now on Instagram. These are the pictures that most people like.
This depresses me. Makes me sad for humanity.
They're not deep.
It's pictures of food and shoes and weirdos.
Yeah.
Like, who is that?
Well, there's a marriage proposal. That's a great thing to do. Do it on Instagram, sure.
Well, who is he talking to? Yeah.
Maybe all of you.
I mean, there's no question that language continually evolves. We're always changing the way that we're trying to convey meaning. But, you know, getting back to the main story, I don't see
that.
Thank you, Padre.
Getting back on the rails, I don't, even granted that communication is shifting, I don't see the value in a purchase like this. Defensive, is it an ACK hire? Were they looking at a core technology? Is there a patent portfolio? The answer to all those questions is no.
I think Jolie hit the nail on the head. The stock, the IPO's coming up.
Oh, yeah.
Mark might have said, if we lose this, it could cost us $1 billion in the IPO. It might be worth it.
It's almost like they just spun a roulette wheel and said, okay, Instagram, they're big right now. So, I mean, give it up for Kevin, the luckiest guy in America.
$400 million.
There we go again.
He gets $400 million out of that.
Although I found the timing really weird because I think they collected a significant round of funding, like something like a day or two before.
And somebody bought in a week before this happened.
How do you not know
Happy
that?
People.
That's a lottery ticket.
Yeah.
Happy people. They won the lottery.
That's probably inside information.
But with your due diligence, how do you not know?
This happened in 2 days.
I agree with John. How do you not know that the company you're investing in is getting acquired by Facebook?
Maybe,
I don't buy it. Yeah. I think somebody knew something.
Well, I think we can take the opposite angle on what she just said, which is not that it was to make Facebook look good to the potential investors and save $1 billion. But now I think potential investors look at it and say, boy, these guys are kind of crazy. This is a dumb idea. This is a stupid thing to do.
Could hurt them.
And I'll tell you, I think this is going on with these guys are going to do a bunch of non-voting stock IPOs. Google's pulling the stunt,
which is completely ridiculous. That's getting people very upset. In fact, they say that's even the most evil thing. Given all the evil things Google's done this year, that's the most evil. We're going to talk about
these retirement funds are going to pull out of Google. You watch.
CalPERS and things like that. And these are big investors, these institutional investors that can make a huge difference in the valuation.
Did Berkshire Hathaway just get into Google? Or was that IBM or something else? I think it was Google.
I'm so
Let
into
me
Google.
Google that.
You know, there is another angle in the story, and that is back when the IPO story was fresh, there was a TNT episode called 57% Zuck. And the whole idea was
he owns most of it.
It's Zuck. If you're investing in Facebook, you're actually investing in Zuckerberg.
Well,
no decision can be made without him. So, I mean, does Zuckerberg just have a liking for Instagram?
That's kind of what the Times article said.
I like this product, so I'm buying it.
I got a bunch of cash. Why not?
I got the checkbook.
Don't you think if they can put those stupid filters on Facebook as a Facebook feature, wouldn't it make Facebook photo sharing even more popular?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, they don't need Instagram to do that.
It makes it easier.
You mentioned the other day there's dozens of
Camera
Instagram
Plus
clones
did
right
it
now.
Beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
You've got in how many filters in your 100 cameras in one?
There's 100, Leo.
It's an amazing thing. So it's not like Instagram has a monopoly.
It's a coincidence that you named it that.
I know. We racked our brains trying to come up with a number.
You know who missed out on this and probably came very close? Hipstamatic, which predates Instagram.
Oh,
I
have a little theory about why that happened. I think the fact that Instagram was willing to go into Android territory made a huge, huge difference in that price, especially.
It happened 2 weeks before the sale.
Yeah, 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, I was at Facebook HQ, and I was talking to them, and they're like, yeah, iPhone's a big deal. Android is as big a deal, and the mobile web is twice as big.
Facebook said this.
Facebook said this to me. They showed us the numbers. And they also said, you know, we see the entire spectrum of mobile access technologies as one and the same. They're all kind of equal.
So that kind of lends credence to the idea that maybe Instagram knew about this ahead of time, and maybe Instagram said, quick, get an Android app,
Far
quick.
Be it from me to come here and posit conspiracy theories. That's John's
job. Because they put this off. I mean, I asked Instagram. Every time I saw them, Android app, Android, they say, we're working on it.
The big question for me is, if they could pay $1 billion for Instagram, why couldn't they throw $100 million at Kodak?
Just to keep
just
alive.
A bone. Come on.
Just a bone.
Actually, Kodak, I was looking at their enterprise value. You'd have to pay $750 million Kodak you own straight
really?
Up. Yeah.
Wow. You know, it's kind of, speaking of the
valuation.
Which
valuations, would be more interesting. And they have all half of these. Yeah.
They have filters. They're made out of glass, but they have. I thought it was kind of interesting that Instagram is actually worth more than the New York Times. Oh, jeez.
Yeah, the whole thing is ludicrous.
It's bizarre. All right. I hope you're enjoying this best of our annual look back at some of the big stories of 2012. Well, we don't do that annually, but some of the big stories of the year. Next year, we'll do 2013, because I guess it would save time in editing if we just did a look back at 2012 from now on. We could really simplify things a little bit. We're going to come back in a second with a look at an announcement that happened twice in 2012, the new iPad. But first, I'd like to talk a little bit about one of our favorite sponsors, a company that's been with us since almost the beginning at Twit, and we really love having them with us, Audible.com. I don't have to tell you about how great audiobooks are. Audible.com is the place to get audiobooks on the Internet. 100,000 strong in every category, fiction, nonfiction. There's history, there's science fiction, there's thrillers, there's mysteries. Of course, you learn a lot at Audible.com, too. There's business books, technology books. I'm just a huge fan. Storm of Swords is coming out, the third book in the Game of Thrones sixology, I guess you'd call it. There's six books, I think, of the Game of Thrones things. But HBO in March will be coming out early next year with the third in the series. I am of the opinion, and I've been doing this, you got to read the book before the show comes out, because, well, I think it enhances your enjoyment of the show, but also you don't want any spoilers before you read the book. So I've read book one and two of Game of Thrones, but now it's time for Storm of Swords. How about getting that for free? That's a lot of hours of Audible content for free. This is part of the good news that Audible has made nearly every book at Audible.com a single credit. This used to be a two-credit book, and it's now a one-credit book, which means you can get it for free and get another book when you go to audible.com/twit2. You'll be signing up for the Platinum account. That's two credits a month. But your first month is free. Your first books are free. You cancel at any time, pay nothing, and they're still yours to keep forever and ever. I want you to try Audible. I really do want you to try Audible. So do me a favor and take advantage of this special offer. Two books, or two credits, depending on the book. But I think Storm of Swords would be one credit. In fact, you could read the next two if you go to audible.com/twit2. Use that special URL so that you get the special deal. audible.com/twit2. I think the Sanderson book's still available, too. So I can make this three books. If you go to audible.com/Sanderson... you can get a copy of Brian Sanderson's great novella, Legion. This was such a good book. Absolutely free. No trial, no credit card, even if you're already a member. audible.com/Sanderson. audible.com/Sanderson. We thank Audible so much for their support and wish them not only the happiest of holidays, but a really great 2013 as we go into it together. Yes, the new iPad is here. We got to say that twice this year. Let's take a look at the first announcement from episode 345. So this was the week the iPad came out. Now, Ms. Worley has not seen a new iPad.
I will ooh what? And ah. I know. Can you believe it?
I haven't seen one yet either. So
you
do
haven't
hold
either?
That.
Well, here, you can look at that.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Isn't that beautiful? Go ahead and just type on that.
What do you think about it, Denise?
Is it? It's really good looking, isn't it? No, I'll tell you, at first I thought this screen was going to, like, your eyes would go like Jessica Rabbit would, boing. But they don't actually do that. It's not immediately apparent how better, much better it is. But as you spend time with it, it gets better and better.
Do you notice it most?
Launch a book application would be one thing to do, because text is, of course, incredibly crisp. So I'll launch the Kindle app and you'll see kind of immediately that. It's
also in video, in HD video, it really, really looks good.
Well, that's one question, because, okay, the the screen is quad resolution, 3.1 megapixels, and it is now, 2048 by 1536 means it could do 1080p video. But on a screen that size, I don't know, is there much of a difference between a 720p video and a 1080p video? Do you notice a difference?
I mean, I was testing some clips I have here, and definitely the 1080p video I downloaded from iTunes
looked better.
Way better on the new iPad versus the iPad 2. I mean, you definitely see the difference. You see the difference in even standard definition video on that screen. Right.
I just feel like it's the same IPS style LCD screen. It's not a Super AMOLED or something, but the resolution is so high. It is, I think, 260 pixels per inch, that it just feels a lot crisper. It feels a lot
softer. Yeah, and the color saturation is higher, too, so colors look better.
But you know what I'm most excited about, and I don't hear a lot about it? I think the camera blows me away.
How are you using it?
So I actually have a question for you. Do you take pictures a lot with your iPad?
Yeah, you want to see what it looks like when I take pictures with my iPad?
Yeah.
For those of you listening, Leo has the cover of the iPad
on his forehead,
like a visor.
I have one of those iPad covers that, see, the camera is right down here. So normally the cover folds over the camera, so I have to do that. Or you could take a picture like this, which is equally kind of dorky, have the cover hang down from the bottom. But you know what? I think we're all going to get used to the idea. Even when I pull it out, it still looks kind of silly. But I think we're all going to get used to the idea because it is, it's essentially the same sensor, I guess, in the iPhone 4 with a lens system from the iPhone 4S. But it is so good.
It really is so good.
And what's different, what's exciting about it is you're seeing the image. It's like a view camera.
That's cool.
Remember the old days when, on the Three Stooges or the Wild West movies, they'd have a guy and he'd have the thing on the tripod and he'd put a black hood over his head and say, "Watch the birdie." And this is, you could almost do that, put a hood over your head, and because now you're seeing a full frame rendition of the picture.
Well, and that the point was made is, when have you ever been able to take the video with the same view as it will be consumed?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so as a result, I think it is a remarkable experience for a videographer or a photographer. And then you add to that that this has got LTE, which is really fast, and you've got great software on it. I think in some ways the camera might be, to me, the most exciting part of this. I really like
it. So
that's interesting.
The innards. Go ahead, Joanna.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I say that's interesting because I just finished writing my review. I've written a number of pieces on the iPad this past week, and I wanted to take some time and write the review. So the review will be up tomorrow. But I come to the conclusion, and I don't want to, I mean, it's the conclusion everyone else has come to, which is really that the screen is the biggest part, but that other biggest improvement is the camera. But I'm not sure a lot of people will buy a new iPad for a camera. But it's funny. I've been hearing that a few people just don't really see the improvement in the screen.
It's not as dramatic as I expected it to be.
Playing the role of John C. Dvorak, mm-hmm. I will step in and say,
what do you think? Are you seeing it for the first time? What do you think?
This is the first moment I've laid eyes on. I know exactly what the specs are. I know everything about it. And that expression that you just had there.
That's your opinion?
I don't know. The camera function's cool. Am I going to use this? I'm a video creator. Am I going to run around and make videos on this and send them off via LTE? No, because I can't depend on it. Is this cool? If I didn't have one, yeah. If I was upgrading from one, maybe. Is this going to make me upgrade from two? Absolutely not.
Here's some video that I shot.
Yeah, that's the ending.
Very good video.
Wow, okay, that looks cool.
Yeah.
it's nice.
It's very, this is walking around. The other thing is it's a little more stable because of its size than a little mini camera or your smartphone.
Right. Yeah.
It's nice that they're incrementally improving the product. But I'm with Becky. I'm not going to upgrade from an iPad 2 to get this device.
Iterative, not innovative. And the teardown was interesting. That big battery, huge battery in
there. They went to 45 watt hours from 25.
Yeah.
And you need to, obviously, for LTE. I think that's more for LTE than it is for the screen, although we don't know. It's got a much faster processor and a much, of course, more dense screen.
But I was wondering, in the Wi-Fi only versions, do you get a boost then?
Yeah. You know? I'm actually... I'm in the corner of my apartment right now running a battery test. I'm running the same HD video on both the iPad 2 and the iPad 3. And I expect that the iPad 2 will last probably a little bit longer or around the same amount of time as the iPad. And I have LTE off, the new iPad. I have LTE off just running on Wi-Fi because I expect that the screen they've boosted the battery just to give you just as much as you would get on Wi-Fi in on the iPad 2 because of the screen.
Yeah, I think we're saying so it's not the LTE then, it is the screen that's sucking all that juice. All right, well, that makes sense.
Right. They say you'll get an hour less with LTE on.
Right.
So they boosted the battery just to compensate enough for that screen.
Wow. So I was completely wrong. It is the screen that's sucking all that juice. Huh. LTE is notorious for being a battery hog, but that's 10% more. If it's only 1 hour, that's going from 10 hours to 9 hours. That's not a huge...
not bad.
One more point on the teardown. $499 retail price, estimated cost to build at $316. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it's more margin than the old one, but that's a decent profit margin.
Yeah.
I think Apple would like more, but of course, I'm sure they make more if you buy the LTE or you buy more RAM.
Right. Yeah. No.
Also in the teardown, we're finding that it has, the A5. I guess we knew everything else. So it's really the battery size that's new information.
It didn't seem like there were any shockers on
nothing
suppliers.
Nothing shocking. A5X in there and so forth.
No, the funny thing was...
I think they also found that there was 1 gig of RAM, which Apple hadn't confirmed.
Same thing with the Apple TV. It's now 512 instead of 256. They doubled the RAM there, too. And Apple never talks about RAM, which is part of this post-PC strategy. We shouldn't have to talk about that stuff.
The specs aren't the issue. It's just about performance.
Can it work?
User
does it do it?
Qualitative, not quantitative. The funny thing about this release is, before I went on vacation, I went out and recorded for my Yahoo show all the wraps for the new announcement. So it was... The new iPad's here. The iPad 3
this
is here.
Before they said, didn't know. iPad HD. You had to go through all the names.
The iPad HD is here. And then I did
Were you smart enough to say just iPad?
You know? Yes, I did the new iPad. I was so stoked. And then this is, the best one was the A5X, is that had come out. Every single thing that was out was almost uniformly
there were no surprises.
Correct. It was absolutely as predicted.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. You should have let me know, because that would have really helped with search placement if we had all known the name.
Next time
it's
I will
so
bring
funny
my...
because I kept calling it the iPad 3 or the iPad HD, and that was just totally wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, that happened to me last
still week. Need to call it the iPad 3, because if you just say the iPad, it's ambiguous, especially since Apple still sells the iPad 2.
But going back to your spec point, they want it to be qualitative,
that's
not
right.
quantitative.
That's
so
right.
New is good enough.
It's all just the iPad.
I wish they had called it the iPad New. It rhymes so well with iPad 2.
iPad new. But then what happens next year? The iPad not
the
so
iPad
new?
Next.
Newer.
The next new.
Newest.
What do you think, Denise? Is this this strikes me as a strange choice.
It does. I can't tell you. They didn't consult with me, so.
It's certainly the stock market didn't mind. The price broke $600 this week for the first time ever. Again, Apple, the most valuable company in the world, on stock price.
Don't you just keep saying it can't keep going up? I feel foolish for having such negativity about the possibility. And then at some point, everyone's going to go, okay, it can go, sky's the limit, whatever, $1 trillion, no problem.
That's what they're talking about now. What is it, $700 billion they're worth now? They're saying, we could be worth $1 trillion. I remember when Apple was stoked, this is how old I am, because they were a $2 billion company.
Wow.
I remember when we were talking about stock price on Mac Break Weekly, we said, it might hit 200, but it sure won't go much higher than that. And Scott Bourne was saying, it'll go higher. It could go to 250. And I thought, you're crazy. So now
you raised an interesting point that Mike Elgin said that the next generation of Bluetooth on this device is actually a big deal.
Oh. Yeah,
can someone explain that to me? Everyone's like, the Bluetooth 4.0 is amazing. That's the big deal. I know nothing.
Is it? I haven't tried it yet. Is it? I mean, how do you really use Bluetooth on a tablet?
Well, for keyboards.
Ah.
Keyboards.
Or for
exactly.
Your car, I suppose.
True.
You have a Ford.
You could have that synced.
CNET saying it's a game changer.
Yeah.
The first Bluetooth smart ready device, allowing it to connect with the billions of Bluetooth devices and the next generation. That's the issue. It's the next generation, I guess. Yeah, I know. That Silverlight just never, I never can keep it quite up to date, can I?
So apparently CNBC right now is announcing or reporting that Apple's going to make an announcement tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. about the company's cash balance.
Yeah.
They say this is breaking.
Yes, this is breaking news, and I was just about to say it. The question is, what would the announcement be?
Dividend?
Yeah. They have $100 billion. They were expected, or it was hoped by some, I think, at the stockholders, meaning that they would offer a dividend, and of course they didn't. They've never offered a dividend.
It's got to be.
You think it's a dividend, or you're going to announce that they're going to buy the planet Earth? Or maybe just Italy. Well, they could just buy Italy.
Okay.
Tim Cook could say, you know, I've always loved Italy. I love the food. I love the wine. I love the people. Let's just buy Italy.
Right. That would make obvious sense.
We could call it Appley.
Okay.
I'm just saying. Appley.
To rival Italy.
In Appley, in olden days.
I'm gonna back into the This American Life story with beep, this little point. Beep,
oh.
Yes, back
it up.
Beep, beep. So here's the deal. There's a story that we'll talk much about, which is This American Life retracting the
episode we can talk about it right now.
About Apple and the Apple factories. But the last act of the episode talking about this thing said that Apple could build their devices in the U.S., the iPhone, for $60 more.
That was the study that came out about a year ago. People might say, oh, it's going to be twice as much. Right. Or it's going to be, it's not a significant difference. So, because they only pay about $5 to the workers in China to make that device.
Right.
So they pay $65 to U.S. workers. Done.
And the supply chain is commoditized that it's, you know, labor isn't that much of a big deal in terms of changing it. So my crazy out there is Apple's building factories in the U.S. and they're going to...
$100 billion, that'd build a few factories. You know what? That would be great PR.
That would be great.
That would be, and
I hope she's right.
It's so outrageous. I'm so wrong, but that's just like my crazy.
No, you know, I love that idea.
That is a great idea.
It's good for America, good for American workers. It solves the problem, this embarrassment with Foxconn.
Well,
I think you're brilliant. Let's do it.
There is a problem.
Yeah.
There is a problem.
There aren't enough workers.
No, it's the supply chain.
It's getting the stuff into China. China.
It's the flexibility. This was the point they made in the in the episode.
It's just-in-time manufacturing.
Yeah. It's like, hey, guys, down the street in, you know, Screw Factory or – that didn't come out right. In Glass –
there's a factory for that?
in Glass Factory or Bracket Factory. Can you make 50 million more of these and get them to us by tomorrow?
Well, they might have to, you know what? They might have to build some of those factories here.
So anyways, that's my kooky end around that. I think that's my wild idea or dividend, but
I like the idea of building factories.
Yeah.
Here. How could, that's a win everywhere. Now remember Steve Jobs, when he went to that famous dinner, it's talked about in the Walter Isaacson biography with Mark Zuckerberg and many other tech, Silicon Valley luminaries. The one thing that Jobs brought up with Obama is, you know, there's too many regulations for me to build a factory here. But remember, in the early days of Apple, they did make Macintoshes here. They did make Apple IIs here. Mm. This is a more recent development, the offshore, the manufacturer. Mm-hmm. Steve was very proud of the next factory where they built the Cube.
Right.
Built here in America.
Designed in California was weird. I mean, that's great. That's super. But I prefer made in America. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, design in California made by slaves in China doesn't have the same ring to it.
New.
Somehow. Nothing like a wonderful warm 8-bit fire on a beautiful holiday eve. I hope you had a great Christmas, great Hanukkah. Your Festivus was the best of us, and you're enjoying your winter solstice activities. New Year's is coming, and as we always do, we're doing a best of twit this year, looking back at the year 2012 and some of our best episodes. More to come in just a moment. Before we do, though, I'd like to thank one of our sponsors who's also been with us all year long. In fact, one of my favorite companies, good friends with the guy who started it, David Friend. He's an interesting character. I don't know, remember ARP synthesizers? He started ARP. Made a lot of money there right out of college. I think he was at MIT right out of college. David went on to do many other startups, but he was kind of retired, taking it easy, when his daughter, who was a college student, called him up and said, Daddy, I just accidentally erased my thesis. You're a geek. Can you help me? And he said, I can't. I have no solution for this. And that's why he founded Carbonite. He said, there's got to be a better way to back up, and Carbonite is the better way to back up. Here's the beauty of it. It's automatic. So you could put it on my daughter's laptop when she went to college. Kind of went full circle on that. So she didn't have to even know that there was a backup solution on there. It just automatically is backing up continuously, too. So she puts the finishing touches on a term paper within minutes. That's backed up. Whenever you're online, Carbonite is always backing up without slowing you down or your computer down. And the nice thing is this Carbonite data is available at any time. So
You've got your term paper backed up. You go to the library. You don't bring your laptop with you. You can still open the term paper on the library computer. Just log into your Carbonite account, and there's all your stuff. You can even do it on a smartphone or a tablet. Carbonite has a free apps there. It's a really great deal. And all of this is just $59 a year per computer. That's less than $5 a month. I would really encourage you to try Carbonite today. Go to carbonite.com. Click the Try It Free button. And use the offer code TWIT. And you'll get 2 weeks without a credit card, just the offer code TWIT. And when you buy, you'll get 2 months free. So a two-week trial, two bonus months, when you go to carbonite.com and use the offer code TWIT. You got to back it up to get it back. So do it right with Carbonite. Let's make 2013 the year that nobody lost any data. Wouldn't that be something? So normally I wouldn't recommend taking stock advice from former MTV VJs. But in this case, Adam Curry got it right. We talked about Facebook's IPO, and this is before it even happened. Oh, quick, reload the fireplace while we watch Adam Curry.
I do want to talk about the Facebook IPO. That's the reason we've gathered you all together today, because and the Zuck got married. I guess Priscilla Chan, who's been dating since before Facebook, since a freshman in Harvard, Priscilla finally said, oh, you're worth $19 billion? I'll marry you. No problem, Mark. What did they wait? They waited to the day after the IPO.
How about this? Oh, man, we got to do something to distract from that failed IPO.
Zuckerberg, don't you have something to get married to?
How do you make some headlines?
Hey, I want a failed IPO that's worth $105 billion.
Let's talk.
That's the headline already, Zuck. It's going to be Zuckerberg changes his status to married.
It's an interesting question. Is it a failed IPO? We'll talk about it in just a second. The Facebook IPO, and here it is, the lovely vision of Mark, the $19 billion man, and his new bride, Priscilla Chan. They got married yesterday in a surprise. They invited people to the wedding and said it was a, what was it? It was like her graduation party.
Yep.
And then instead she shows up in white. She's graduating from spinsterhood. We're going to take a break. Come back with more. Adam Curry. Actually, it's the Podfather, the Godfather, and the Scobalizer.
Doesn't quite fit.
One of these things is not like the other. So really interesting to hear you say a Facebook failed IPO, Adam. And I'm not sure I disagree with you. The underwriters decided to set the price before the IPO yesterday morning at $38. That was the price that if you were an insider, like you were a big trader with your brokerage, you could say, hey, cut me some of that Facebook stock. And, you know, it's the biggest tech IPO in history. It wouldn't be unreasonable to think it's going to what they call pop, which is come out at $38 but end up at $100 or $50 or whatever. And then even if you just wanted to sell at the end of the day, you'd make pretty good money. So
I took my company public in 96.
Oh, you've done this.
Yeah, I have. That was a huge IPO, a big raise, $15 million. It was amazingly large.
Was this Metaverse?
No, this was Think New Ideas.
Oh, okay.
And which we later sold successfully to another public listed company, so, like 2 months before the bubble burst.
Yeah, you were in the bubble.
Well, 96 was a little bit before it, and you know we were making money, which was good. We had clients, but it was back in the day when we'll build a Reebok's website for $100,000. I mean, yeah, and then $10,000 a month maintenance. Yeah, so this is We saw the writing on the wall eventually, but I went through the process of taking a company public, and what it really comes down to is pricing the night before. And so it's the size of the float, the number of shares, and what the actual price per share is going to be. And I think they got greedy. And when investors, and of course, there was a lot of, more interesting to me was the coverage of the IPO, because you saw the day before GM came out.
Oh, it was the Super Bowl.
Yeah,
and then people were GM not, tanked them. Yeah.
I think it had to do with it. But if you look at right now, they're trading 74, almost 75 times earnings. And that's very, very high. I mean, I'm pegging the stock to go down to 17. That's where I think it belongs. I think that's reasonable for what they can do, what they've shown historically in revenues and profits.
So that's the problem. You know, I was watching. It was really treated like the Super Bowl. I was watching. I got up at 5:30 a.m. to watch CNBC because it was like a big event. They had reporters down at Hacker Square at the Facebook thing. There were, and of course, Facebook was smart. They had the hackathon the night before, so there were thousands of employees there. Zuck spoke. They hooked up the NASDAQ bell there in Silicon Valley so he could press the. There's no bell for NASDAQ. It doesn't have a trading floor, but he pressed the button to start the trading day. And
then it took another half an hour.
Yeah. And then a little later, they start selling.
Here's the problem with these IPOs. And I saw, and yes, I saw this in the bubble. So you have people who came into the company recently. They're getting options. Their strike price is going to be maybe a little bit under 38. Any new hires that come in, you can't just reshuffle the option pool. That's a big deal. So they have a strike price. And let's say, just for argument's sake, it's going to be around that 38 number. So now people are going to be very worried, like, oh, you know, either I have stock or I'm in lockup for 6 months. I can't sell anything. So on paper, I may look like I have $1 million. But every day it's going to be like, oh, how's the stock doing? How's the stock doing?
That's not good.
Huge distraction.
That's really what you don't want.
Particularly when it's going down, it really, really hurts a company. And I think that's what we see with Facebook.
I think that's BS. At Rackspace, when we went IPO, the stock went down and it didn't distract us. And the stock since then has gone up 10, I think about 10 times. You know, just to go out to IPO, you're trying to raise money for the company.
Yeah, let me understand this.
They priced this perfectly.
Does $38 does that which is what they decided to sell it for? Does all of that money go to Facebook? Is that like what? So Facebook said we're going to have how many shares? Almost 1 million shares, right? At $38. Well, I forgot what it was. The total number of shares.
Well, not the entire amount because the insiders sold. So yeah. A portion of that went to a large portion, of course. Went to the people who sold the stock.
That's actually an important point. Some of these guys are making money right away. Like they got a check.
All the underwriters made a ton of money.
Peter Thiel, for instance, who famously invested, was the first investor in Facebook, invested $500,000, ended up with $848 million on Friday. And he still has another $852 million shares, dollars worth of shares current price remaining.
But
Zuck made $1.5 billion in cash, right like that. Mm-hmm. And he still has $19 billion outstanding.
If I could take a contrarian position here, I mean, I know why people are saying this is a bust, because they were expecting for the price to double, to go back to the good old days of the bubble when you would have an incredible rise in the stock price and the IPO was when people get paid. This is not a regular IPO. You're talking about a company that is 57% owned by a single man. All he wanted was operating capital for his company.
I don't think he even needed to do this. I think the SEC rules made him do this. At least they made him disclose to a certain point, and I think they figured, well, as long as we have to do all the disclosure a public company has to do, we might as well raise money on the stock market. But I don't think that this was – I think they put it off as long as they could, right? They could have done this a year ago. They could have done this 2 years ago.
Partly that's hype. Because
you don't think so? You know Mark better than anybody.
I think he put it off to raise the price.
He wanted to make as much
as
he could.
Every minute that Facebook is out there, the price goes
risky
up.
Risky game, though.
It is a risky game.
Because the price could
also
go down.
It paid off. He collected $104 billion on Friday for his investors and his company. Now, I mean, on Friday night, what did he do? He went and bought a mobile company called Karma, right? He's going to have He's going to have the resources to take over a lot of things.
Right.
And this is very good for Facebook. Also, on the other side, the transparency is going to force Facebook to be an adult company for once.
I think that's what Mark didn't want, though.
No, I think he does.
He did?
I think he does. He knows he's moving his company into being a brand that everybody respects and trusts. That is those two words are not used with Facebook today.
Well, in fact, with GM pulling out, it's $10 million worth of advertising, which is not a huge amount.
But GM pulled out of the Super Bowl, too. Is the Super Bowl dead?
In fact, I think it's more of a comment on GM's inability to use these markets appropriately than it is a comment on the use of
Facebook. More interesting is how do they actually make money? If you have a so-called 900 million people, which I don't believe is correct, I think it's probably a fraction of that. But okay.
Really?
I think that everyone has multiple accounts. The SEO guys have 50 accounts. It's just a matter of how you count things. But in the case of Rackspace, Robert, that's a business where you're providing a service and people pay for it. I have 5 Rackspace servers. I love the service. I have an Amazon S3 servers, EC2. But we have yet to show that you can really place a good value on essentially display banner advertising. That's all they've got so far. And quite honestly, for the company that knows so much about the social graph, how could they not figure out that this IPO was mispriced? You know, they should have had all the information at their fingertips. What,
was it mispriced, though? They announced it at $38, and it came out at $38. If they came out at $17 and it went to $38, they would have not left money on the table. The purpose of doing an IPO is to raise money for your investors in the company.
You can't disagree, Adam. They raised the most money that they possibly could have raised, right?
Because it kept hitting 38 because the underwriters were buying stock like crazy to keep it above.
They kept it at 38. You think?
Okay, on Monday it'll go down, and so you know
because they can't do that forever.
But they took the most amount of money off the table that they possibly could.
There was some
should have been a 37 or 35, maybe, but.
It's 120. The price to earnings ratio is 122.
This is not a normal IPO. This is not
that means that the stock price is 122 times what they earn.
Yeah.
That's crazy. And one of the reasons, and now I'm watching CNBC and Jim Cramer, who was actually great on this, and I was surprised because seems like he's kind of crazy. But he was great on it. He said, well, what you can't account for is what's going to happen with the retail sales. You know the institutional investors pushed back about this price. But there was some concern that everybody who loves – all the kids who love Facebook would just say, well, I don't know anything about the stock market or price to earnings, but I want to buy Facebook. It's a good – and would buy it. And that's what the thought was, that this would pop, that it would go up to $50. Because – and you know what? The kids or whoever did not fall for this. They looked. Somebody looked at the price to earnings.
Somebody fell
and
for
said
it.
It's too high. Well,
somebody
it came
fell
back.
For it. It still is.
It went up to
$144 billion right now.
It went up to 45.
This is the largest IPO of history. It's not GM when they went out with their recent IPO.
Is Facebook worth more than Citigroup?
Yes.
It's worth more than these other companies. Really? All right.
Yes. We look at Facebook all day long. We're addicted to it,
but we're going to get more addicted to it.
And how often do you click on an ad, Robert?
I click on a lot of ads, but I'm playing around with it. The ads that are going to come are going to be on mobile. He's making $0 on mobile right now, and I can see a lot. And by the way, somebody said I bought a lot of stock. I don't own any stock in this company.
Well, we should say right now. Who owns Facebook stock here?
I don't own any.
I don't.
I can't afford it.
Okay, yeah. So... just so you know, I don't buy tech stock. Nobody here buys tech stock.
The time really to buy it for normal people to buy Facebook is right after the Google I.O. conference, because that's going to be where it either gets slammed because Google's going to announce something or it's going to start rising or do whatever. But at that point, then that's where rational.
But how do you answer Adam's criticism that Facebook's revenue right now is banner ads, display ads, which don't work?
He's absolutely right. But well, that's part
that's
of the story, right? I mean, that's why he
drunk
needs this capital.
Click on ads so they can get more drunk people.
I don't
Facebook.
Think it's about clicking on ads,
so,
anyways.
So when people are investing in Facebook, there's a presumption that, well, Zuck is the fundamentals of this company are going to be good because Zuck is smart and he's going to figure out mobile.
Coca-Cola owns a sign in downtown San Francisco that costs, I don't know, $200,000 a month, something like that.
But they're selling sugar water.
But why do they do that? Is it because you go up to the sign and click on it? No, it's there on the side and it reminds you that Coca-Cola exists. This is why advertising is done. This is why Stamps.com bought an ad on your show to remind people that they exist.
I mean, one of the things it's not all about clicks.
This is not a regular IPO.
Stamps.com is not necessarily branding. Part of it's branding, but it's also per inquiry. So there's a call to action. You need to either put in a code. All the ads work that way. I think the only brand advertiser is Ford, possibly, and they're making a connection with a tech-savvy audience. It's not exactly the same. And again, Coca-Cola sells an actual product. People take money out of their pocket and hand it to the company.
Yeah.
This is the difference. I mean, we've been through this. We've seen this. The banner advertising, it's marginal. And how do you grow if you really have 900 million people? How do you scale? How much bigger can you go? All of a sudden, you're going to make five times as much from each person?
Yes, they're making zero on mobile, and there's hundreds of millions of people who only use Facebook on mobile.
You know, all they have to make is a couple of bucks per user. Maybe it's not 900 million, as you say, Adam. Maybe it's, let's say, what would you stipulate? 100 million?
150 million.
150 million.
I'd say.
So all they have to do is make 10 bucks per person per year to justify their stock price.
Yeah.
Could they do? Can you make 10 bucks per person per year?
You can with the money that you just raised in the IPO. I mean, again,
spending that money, acquisitions?
Spending that money in acquisitions and in development. I mean, one of the things that we keep forgetting is This is not a regular IPO. If this had been another LinkedIn, or if this had been another Groupon, absolutely, this was a bust. But this was a man who, by all means, has done very well for his company. Getting money for him to be able to invest in his money so he can leverage those 900 million users.
So you're not buying stock at Facebook. You're buying stock at Mark Zuckerberg.
Right. Well, right now it's irrational. I totally agree with Adam that the price is completely crazy right now. And it's crazy because we all use Facebook all day long. Buy brands. We buy stock.
Adam,
that we
admit
use.
That you're an outlier.
Yeah, possibly. But I do have an account. I only use it to see what my daughter's doing and to terrorize her friends. I love doing that. That's a lot of fun.
That's
terrorizing
not a
my
bad,
daughter's friends.
That's a good reason to have
you know,
a Facebook.
People are saying, no, we don't. Okay, I just was recently at Disney World and I walked around and I looked at what people were doing on their phones. 70% were on Facebook.
Yeah.
Walking around
people
Disney
clearly
World.
Clearly use Facebook. There's no question about that. I think when
but
you buy Facebook,
internet.
No, but
it's
yeah,
a
yeah.
Difference.
But, people
Facebook
use Google. Google's making money.
Network.
Google's a valuable stock. It's at $600. I don't think the PDE is the same. But so the question is, can Mark figure out a way? I think you're betting that Mark will make some magic and figure out a way to make money on mobile. And I don't think it's too. You don't have to think too hard to think of a way or many ways he could make money on
and
mobile.
And here's how. I'm looking at Flipboard. I'm looking at a GigaOm article in Flipboard. And when I page through this. Whoa, there's a Polycom ad, a full-page ad.
And that goes, by the way, not to Flipboard, but to GigaOm, right?
Yes.
That's a GigaOm
well,
ad.
Well, GigaOm is sharing They're a sharing. Revenue with right. Flipboard, right? And then you turn the page, and you're back to GigaOm. This
but is
how,
that ad work? You know what? I'll be honest. I just skip it real quick.
But these are ads like Wired Magazine has. And is
well,
Wired
I don't
Magazine,
think those work. I think those don't work either.
They work enough for people to keep doing them and have been doing them for years. Right?
Okay. I think we can agree. The stock price was too high, except not for Facebook, but for investors. Facebook was just right because they made a lot of money. The question is, next week, what's the stock price? What's your target price, Adam, for Facebook in a week, in a month, in a year?
Okay, I can give you the 5 month and 5 year scenario.
Good.
Five months, the stock is at 17. 5 years, we're not talking about Facebook anymore. It's something else.
It's not a long-term hold.
No.
You're a short on Facebook.
We've seen this movie. Look at what has AOL become. Now it's a giant Xerox machine run by Ariana Huffington. I mean, we've seen GeoCities.
I think you're nuts.
MySpace.
That is Adam, exactly right. Adam, by the way, what a great characterization of AOL.
Adam, is it true or what?
That's exactly right.
I think Adam is correct on one of the predictions, which is short term, I see it going down. Long term, he is going to turn on mobile revenue, and for the next 5 quarters, he is going to beat his numbers, and that is going to cause the stock to have lift.
Target
price. This is what happens. This is what happens, and by the way, this is Zuckerberg's brilliance. Zuckerberg knew we were all going to buy this stock coming out of the gate, so he sandbagged us. He kept this revenue off the table until after the IPO.
Oh, he's been hiding his revenue.
He's been hiding the mobile revenue.
He's been slow playing his hand.
You watch. By the end of summer,
you're saying he's got five aces.
But I think he's going to turn on this style of mobile advertising over the next couple of months. And he's probably going to turn it on right during the Google I.O. conference. Because Google is going to come out with a bunch
That's
of stuff
timing.
For Google Plus. Right?
Slap him
around and announce a whole bunch of new things and announce a new open graph.
Do you know
style
something we don't know, or is this
I keep
speculation?
Hearing rumors. It's a little bit of speculation, but a little bit of informed.
Adams, that sounds right. I mean, sir, there's no. Everybody would agree that Zuck is a sly devil. Right.
Well, I think he built a really great service and you know, oh, thank you, love. That's perfect. Perfect timing. Yeah.
Did she bring you another fine beverage?
Thank you. I needed that right about now.
This is what I always love about daily source code, by the way. People,
yeah, wait until 30 minutes from now. No, he built something great, but it's not part of the network. And with the network, I mean the internet. I do not believe in the advertising banner click model. I think, yeah, if you turn it on mobile, sure, you know, people will misclick. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Well, I clicked on it anyway. I just don't see the model as something that really works anymore. I think it's, you know, the only way you can make money with banner advertising, which is essentially what they do. I've looked at all the presentations. I follow it. I'm very interested. Is high volume, high volume of lots of people, some of them will be drunk, some of them will make a mistake, some of them will be interested, no doubt about it. But early on, brands were all sold on this how many likes a brand had. And, advertisers are very, very smart. Agencies, not so. Agencies will sell a bunch of crap to the advertiser. But the advertiser, at the end of the day, go, hey,
did
man,
it make us money or not? They're going, yeah, it's not return making any money. On investments. Very simple. Yeah. So are you saying that the open, free and open internet will return?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, this is the pendulum that always swings back and forth. I think the internet, if the internet was meant, it was not meant to be centralized. It wasn't built that way. I think we will see mom and pops. I hope we'll see mom and pops popping up again, who will provide email to 100 people, you know, email services. There'll be, you know, little smaller cloud things. I mean, my goodness, my fiance just moved to iCloud, and you know the mail's not working, it you know craps out. I mean, this is hard stuff, and the more scale you have, the harder it gets. And if you do it in a smaller, I run my own mail server here at home, you know, I got like 3 accounts on it, it's enough, it works. So we're going to have to go back to that, and because of Facebook's inherent closed nature, it's not a part of the network. So
that's why the analogy to AOL is apt, because that was also a walled garden.
Yeah.
That everybody used and thought, many people thought it was the internet.
Except we haven't seen, you know, all my favorite apps, you know, whether it be Foursquare or Spotify or...
how much money are they making, Robert? Seriously.
Well, this is where he's going to turn on these new mobile ad networks.
Talk about Foursquare and talk about Twitter.
That's him making some.
Isn't
but it's
that
not
the bubble that we're in right now is that, well, this is location somehow going to turn a huge profit. You can't have this many users telling you this much about themselves without making money on it.
Yeah.
And the question is how?
And that's the big $64,000 question.
Robert, what do you think? Robert's stuck out here in left field.
I've been hearing the end of the walled garden since the demise of AOL.
They keep coming back.
It keeps coming back. We keep going to a larger walled garden. Now, Facebook is not a MySpace. We've already seen that. You know, but Facebook has... Is yes, right now they've
They're
got
not a MySpace yet.
They're not a MySpace,
MySpace
yet.
MySpace had tons of ads and it didn't work for them.
And what Adam's
it was a
talking
terrible,
about
terrible
is perfect. Yeah, it was only banner ads, and banner ads died in MySpace. But Facebook has something else, and I'm not bringing out the mystic Zuck anymore. I'm talking about it's gone beyond a critical mass where you have an ecosystem where you have people who are willing to buy the brand, not just the advertising in the site, but the actual brand for Facebook. And I think you've given a man who, again, I think is very intelligent, a huge war chest that he can now go out and get what he needs to get more money out of his 900 million users without it just being banner advertising.
Yeah.
I don't know what that's going to be yet, though.
I mean, look at Flipboard. This is my Facebook feed. It doesn't look like Facebook, but it's my Facebook feed.
And how does Facebook monetize that?
Well, they can buy Flipboard. And then they can put those full-page ads like GigaOm has right in there, and they can have audio ads in SoundCloud,
but,
right?
But I think Adam's saying that the display ads don't work.
I think they do. Otherwise, Wired Magazine would not exist.
But I can think of a lot of magazines that are gone.
A lot of magazines have disappeared, but a lot have come. I mean, when I go to
what's
there's
Wired
so many
magazine circulation. What's its circulation? People do actually pay for the magazine.
I don't think
Let's
you're actually. Yeah, I don't think you're using a very good example, Robert. I hate to tell you, I don't know if display ads work. I really think that's what's going on right now.
So is there going to be there still is demand from advertisers to get in front of your face. Why did Stamps.com just sponsor your show?
Well, and I think Adam makes a very good point. Stamps.com calculates return on their investment very carefully. It's
they
a little
exactly
harder for Ford because it's a brand builder. But you're right. And Ford even wants to do a lot of research. They're researching constantly to see if they're getting brand recognition. So no company that's spending ad dollars and is intelligent is spending ad dollars into a vacuum. They're checking, does this work? Does this produce results? One way or the other, they're not. And I think you're right, Adam. I don't know if it's the agencies that are that smart, but the advertisers whose actual money it is are very careful about where they're putting it. And in fact, I think that's one of the reasons you're seeing a real softening in banner ads right now, aren't we? Display ads are down.
It's horrible. I mean, what do you get for a click these days?
Nothing.
Penny?
Yeah. So I think that, and that's why advertisers are starting to demand, acquisition cost per acquisition instead of cost per click or cost per impression. They really want to make sure that they're getting their money's worth.
Yeah.
So I don't – I think it's a – but this was all brought up before the IPO. Everybody said, well, here's the negatives. It could be another MySpace. Everybody could vacate Facebook because somebody else comes along. It could they haven't shown that they know how to produce revenue, and they certainly aren't producing enough revenue to justify that price right now. It's clear people who bought Facebook – and by the way, I would buy it if I could – believe in Zuck and believe in him and his team and his ability to somehow turn 900 million –
well, and the
users, and we could say if it's Adam's case, 900 million eyeballs,
and they're believing in their own usage
into something.
Model. They're believing in their own usage model. They're staring.
Well, and that was the dumb retail buyers that Jim Cramer was worried about. People who said, "Well, I like Facebook, I like McDonald's, I'll buy their stock without even thinking, is this a good value?"
Yeah,
because that's the question. You may like Maserati, but is it $1 million car? Facebook's selling $1 million car here, right? Is that what we're saying, Adam? That this is just overpriced.
Well, if it was a car, it would do something for me.
Now,
selling a sticker.
Now
on the
there
car.
We can go. Now I can really bite on you.
Facebook
man.
Does do something for you.
Yeah, you know, and this
it
is,
helps you get laid, if nothing else.
No, Facebook is a new.
Oh, I'm sorry, Father. Please forgive me.
I thought that was Craigslist.
Craigslist.
Oh, he's smarter than I thought.
And informed.
We'll do confession later.
I hear confession, so it's,
I mean, Facebook is a new media company where the media comes to you based on who you are. Yahoo is the old media company. You had to go to yahoo.com/sports or yahoo.com/sports.
It was a portal. That was the portal model.
And Facebook, you just sit here and it comes. I mean, it's been coming to me during this show. Media comes to me. And
one of the reasons
to me because I told it
who
I am. How many ads
did you click on during the show?
What's that?
How many ads did you click on during the show?
I haven't Zero. Clicked on anything. I'm just watching it. No. There's a Verizon Fios ad right at the top here. I wish
Robert.
I could click on that Verizon Fios ad and buy Fios at my house, but they don't serve it in my house yet.
I like the idea that people are using Facebook. You know, I think the ability to find people and to have an address book of people online. That's the real magic sauce that Facebook provided. Now people are doing pretty much what they always do, you know, post funny pictures, quote of the day, here's my plate of food.
You really need to come and spend a couple hours with me and see what's on my screen because I have none of that stuff on my screen.
You know what we need to get? We need to get Ben Ha in here because if he can turn Icon Has Cheeseburger into money, then Facebook can turn its sites into money, right?
So there's a high volume business.
Right.
Very high volume.
Yep, lots of clicks.
With
lots
extreme virality, completely open, by the way. You don't need an account to take a look at it. And I don't know what he's doing. I don't know how much he's making. I'm sure he's making enough for his company and for himself. And I think there's validity in that. You know, Leo, you're doing extremely well with the Twit network, but I don't think you actually believe you can scale it to a $1 billion company.
Oh, no.
And nor would you want to necessarily.
No.
And that I think is, you know, there's a couple things going on here that are very exciting to me. If you look at Kickstarter, there's a very interesting model where you have a company that's facilitating the connection of people and is taking a piece of the action and people are getting what they want. And this is really the future. And I think the network itself is going to facilitate that tremendously where I want a product. I want, there you go. So
$10 million on the Pebble watch. Yeah.
Yeah. So you want it and you know, it's going to cost $2.99 when it comes out, but you know what? I want it so bad. I'll toss these guys $50 to get it going. This is an incredibly interesting model. This is going to kill Hollywood and every other industry is people, users actually saying, I want this and here's how I want it. And I don't care who makes it for me, but just let's get it going. We don't need to wait for stuff. And here's the exact specification.
You don't think I think there's going to be Kickstarter fatigue that people are going to start to realize. For instance, I've participated in 4 or 5 Kickstarter projects. One was Diaspora, $100 mm-hmm. down the tube. One was some dice that I never got, $150 mm-hmm. bucks down the tube. Yeah. Don't you think that there's going to be Kickstarter fatigue that as inevitably, many of these projects are not going to produce a product that's worth anything. Who knows if that Pebble watch that I spent $125 on is going to work, is going to be any good? I think we're in a bubble, a Kickstarter bubble. I cannot imagine this is going to continue.
I'm just waiting for the first really bad case.
There's going to be a horrible example. Somebody takes $10 million and goes to Bermuda.
Woven's on Kickstarter, right? So they're trying to raise money, yeah. Right.
I mean, it's a great model right now. These guys, these Pebble guys are very, very happy. They asked for $100,000. They got $10 million in a month. It just closed this week.
Yeah.
And I ordered a watch. But, you know, that's a pretty what I don't think people who use Kickstarter realize is how speculative what you're doing is. There's no guarantee you're going to get diddly out of that.
Yeah. I've been to WIM, which also makes a watch, and there was a Y Combinator company that makes a watch, and
this is a bubble. This is not going to continue.
By buying a share of Facebook, I mean, there's no guarantees anywhere. No. Same amount you probably spent on the watch.
You know, Adam, I agree with you. I think in a few months we're going to see Facebook below $20. I absolutely believe that. But I also believe that if at that point it got down to, say, $17 and I actually had money to invest, I would invest in Facebook, not for Facebook, but for Zuck. Zuck has delivered. I mean, you can spin it many different ways, but he does have a vision, and I see that going elsewhere. And I think it actually goes beyond
but
social.
But you're really doing a disservice then, because you're not giving Zuck anything. You're buying something from somebody else.
So no, and Zuck already got his.
If 900 million people said, hey, we really like this, let's give Zuck, you know, $1 a month, what a great business. I would be jumping for joy, but why doesn't it work? Why doesn't anyone go that route?
That's interesting. I mean, I'm not recommending they do it. What if Facebook did say, let's start charging $1 a month? Could they do that?
Probably.
Yeah.
Some people would stay there.
I think they could, actually.
Yeah.
For $1 a month, make it cheap. Make it $5 a year.
You'd find out really quickly which accounts are actually
paid. Yeah, you would. Welcome back to our best of for the year 2012 for TWIT. And I want to thank the folks at Water Wings Productions, waterwingsproductions.com, for our fabulous Super 8-Bit Fireplace for today's episode, keeping my butt warm throughout the show. Coming up in just a little bit, the chimney. Coming up in just a little bit. We're going to take a look at the launch of the Surface, or at least the announcement of the Surface, both RT and the Surface Pro. Before we do, though, I'd like to talk a little bit about my friends at Ford. You know what Christmas is going to bring me? Well, didn't bring me yet. By next Christmas, I really want the Ford Fusion Energy. This is the plug-in hybrid, which should be coming out in the next month or so. You know I'm a big Ford fan, and one of the reasons I'm interested in the 2013 Fusion, 2013 Taurus, too, is because I can get the blind spot information system, BLIS, with it, including cross-traffic alert. This is a really cool technology. Sensors in the rear panels of the vehicle monitor the blind spot. You know, whenever you drive, no matter how good you are with the mirrors, and there's always a part of the car behind you or in the left and the right of you can't see. But what's great, and by the way, it's one of the number one reasons for auto accidents, lanes changing into oncoming traffic. So BLIS stops that, because what it does is it monitors vehicles on either side, and it detects traffic. If another vehicle's in your blind spot, you'll get an audio and visual alert warning you, a little bleep in your mirror. So you totally know. The cross-traffic alert uses the same technologies to warn you as you're pulling out of a... Ever have this happen in a parking spot at the mall? You know, there's two big SUVs on either side of you or pickup trucks. This happens all the time in Petaluma. Everybody drives a pickup truck except me. And they're on either side of you, and you can't see around them, so you're kind of slowly edging out of the parking space. The blind spot assist is fantastic, because it can see around corners. It sees if there's any oncoming traffic. So as you're slowly pulling out, you can observe, and you'll know if somebody's coming your way. That's a super neat technology. They also have Active Park Assist, and I've used that, and I can't wait. Are you good at parallel parking? Maybe you are. Active Park Assist is better. I don't care how good you are. You push a button as you're driving by parking spaces, and it's measuring the size of the parking space. When it sees one you'll fit into, it says, whoa, parking space, pull forward. You pull forward. And then when you get to a certain point, you take your foot off the gas. Keep your foot on the brake. That was my mistake. Keep your foot on the brake, because once you park, you're going to have to stop the car. And then it's so weird. The wheel goes, and you do all the perfect geometry pulling into the parking space. If you've never used the Active Park Assist on a Ford vehicle, you've got to try it. It's amazing. Amazing. In 24 seconds, you're parked perfectly. All you do is operate the accelerator, the gear selector, and the brake pedal. I wish they'd told me that before I tried it. That's all I'm going to say. It is fantastic. Ford is putting great technology in their automobiles, technology you can take advantage of if you get one of the new 2013 Ford Fusions or 2013 Ford Taurus. These are available technologies in both, or you can go to ford.com/technology to learn more.
Thank you, Ford. Ford has been such a blessing to us this year. One of our biggest advertisers and a huge support to what we're doing here at TWiT. So if it comes around that there's a time you need to buy a car, I hope you'll consider Ford as a way of saying thank you to them for supporting us. Now, ready to move on? All right. This next segment is Dvorak on this one? Who's on this? Well, we'll find out in a second. Microsoft announced for the first time ever, this was huge, that they're going to make their own PCs. Watch. So is it hyperbole of me to say the biggest week in the history of Microsoft from Microsoft's point of view? Larry, did you go down?
No, I was in Washington, D.C., but it was a big week. I mean, between tablets and phone operating systems, I don't know the biggest. Does it beat Windows 95 or Windows 3.0?
It's probably pretty close to Windows 95, I would say.
It's pretty big. It's a big deal for them because they're betting the company on Metro. They're betting the company on their own hardware. Rumor is that they may have their own phone. That's a huge departure for Microsoft. So maybe it is the biggest week.
It is. It isn't. Isn't it a new Ryan Block? You weren't there either.
I did not go. No.
Yeah.
I mean, it was definitely the biggest week I can think of since the Xbox 360 launch.
You know, I do remember when the main Xbox, the first Xbox launch, that was a pretty
that
big
was that
deal.
Was a we big one. But the Seattle 360, I think, was much bigger.
360.
Yeah.
But I have to say, this to me is huge because Microsoft's changing its business model. Yeah. A really good. John Gruber wrote a piece about it on Daring Fireball, referring back to a guy named Didiou, and I don't from a Simco blog.
Yeah.
I don't know, but he wrote, I thought, a very intelligent piece in which he essentially said, do the numbers, and what Microsoft realized was the writing on the wall. They'd made all their money selling expensive software on commodity hardware. And really, Dvorak would always joke, well, whose wallet would you rather have, Bill Gates or Steve Jobs? It's better to be in the low overhead software business because it's all profit. But all of a sudden, that seems to have changed. And Apple has proved that, in fact, there's more profit in doing inexpensive software on very expensive hardware. And Didiou's premise is Microsoft saw the curves intersecting and said, we've got to do something about this. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't think that they're looking at it as they're going to make money on the software. I think that they're looking at it as one, you know, owning the whole banana, right, as we say. And a lot of this actually kind of goes back before the iPhone. As we really started to adopt mobile devices, something changed, and that was we had integrated experiences, and you know, that means at least in my opinion, you know, a software stack and a hardware stack that are very closely tied together and that are not necessarily commoditized. And if they don't work well together, the whole thing falls apart. And so we started getting used to this, and then Apple raised the game with the iPhone. And then all of a sudden, it stopped being about operating system and hardware and, you know, pick your hardware, pick your operating system. It became single great experiences that people came to expect.
Right.
And I think that that's what Microsoft really realizes. You have to, at some point, sooner or later, to match the great experiences other companies are creating, you have to own the whole banana.
Mm-hmm. Horace says that by doing a little division, Microsoft, if you include the Office licenses and the Windows licenses, makes about $78 of operating profit per PC sold. Remember, they don't make the PC, they just make the software. He says Apple, if we do a little math, makes $195 per iPad sold. And as iPads start to outsell PCs...
We're talking about Surface.
Well, yeah.
Or a tablet.
Well, that's why they had to do Surface, because they were only doing the software, and then, of course, Lenovo and Dell and HP are doing the hardware. There's not much margin in hardware in the PC
world. Well, this is a major competitive disadvantage that they had for their hardware partners in the tablet space, because I think what I'd read, and I don't have this confirmed yet because I'm not sure if the final OEM pricing is out, but I think I'd read that they were going to charge $75 to $85 for Windows RT, which is their version of iOS.
Basically. So that would be the licensing cost to a tablet manufacturer.
Right. So if I'm Asus and I want to create a Windows-based tablet, I'm going to have to pay $75 just for the OS, which if you look at the breakdown of what goes into one of these things, $75 is enormous. That's at par or maybe even slightly more than, you know, the incredible display on the iPad
Ryan,
3.
Isn't that a game killer for the third-party ecosystem?
That's exactly what I'm saying. It's a huge competitive disadvantage to those guys because they can't compete on price with anyone else if they have to do $75 cost for the OS. So for Microsoft, it actually makes a lot of sense.
Plus the fact, I don't know how good the hardware is going to finally be when we see the actual final version of it, but I would guess that Microsoft's going to do a really good job on the Surface tablet relative to other companies that are going to create tablets using the same software. In fact, I think Google did a superb job on its phones relative to HTC and some of the other players that, in terms of the branding. And so I think that essentially they're going to kill the entire ecosystem, which I don't get it in that sense. I mean,
wait a minute.
I don't know about that.
I think they're going to kill. I agree that they're going to kill the ecosystem on the tablet on Windows RT. But I think that there's still. I mean, look at Dell, Lenovo, HP. They've still got to sell Windows machines. They're going to sell Windows 8, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Or are they just going to be all Windows 7? What about Robert? Yeah. You deal with business. Business isn't moving to Windows 8.
No, it's not. But this is why you've had in this last week the CEO of Acer came out and essentially
he laughed. He said they're not going to make this.
Yeah, he said Microsoft was going to fail, and the reason he gave for them failing is they're creating two products. They're creating their own product, and they're creating the third-party market for the Surface tablet.
But you know what? They only need one to win.
They only need one to win. Acer actually bet the farm against tablets. At CES this last year, they essentially surrendered the tablet market.
That would be another reason for Microsoft to do tablets.
Exactly.
Even at Computex, we didn't see a lot of Windows RT tablets, right? I mean, it looked like I'm going to make a prediction. I got two predictions. And I agree with you, by the way. It's not just financial. It's also because integrating hardware and software makes sense. That's Apple's big advantage, right? They give a better user experience. I think by doing what they've done, Microsoft's going to – there's two things that are going to happen. One, I don't think anybody's going to make a Windows RT tablet. I think that it's all going to be Windows 8.
I don't know about that. I think you'll still see people making it. The problem is they're going to be – well, go ahead and make it.
And there aren't going to be many apps, even though there is – you know, in theory, you could push a button when you make a Windows 8 Metro app and it's a Windows RT app. I think we've seen so many tablets like the Playbook, like the Zoom, like the Android tablets just die because there weren't enough apps for those tablets. There was no ecosystem. So $75, it's an unproven system. You can make it's just going to be difficult. You can make an Android tablet if you really want to make a tablet, at least have a shot at it. Microsoft's, you know, kind of in the market. So how are you going to compete against Microsoft? So I think this kills Windows RT, except for a Microsoft product. And I think they'll kill it quickly enough because it's not going to be selling very well with just them making it. I think it also means Windows 7 gets an end of life in 2025 because I don't think business wants to go to Windows 8. I think Microsoft is going to essentially cede the Windows 7 market to the Lenovos, the Dells. They're going to make Windows 8 Pro tablets. And it's going to be a very different PC world.
This is very doom and gloom for you. I mean, you think it's going to just it's going to fail.
I think Windows RT will fail. I think Windows 7's got a long life ahead of it because business needs it and wants it. I think Windows 8 is going to take a long time for it to get any traction.
If Windows RT doesn't work out, just so we're totally clear, that is Microsoft's entire tablet strategy right now.
That's tablet.
But it's not just tablets.
Wait, what about the one that comes out next year that runs regular Windows 8 and that runs the full-blown apps?
I guess it's kind
that's
of
that's too fun. That's the Windows 8 pedantic. Pro tablet. Right?
Yeah, it's kind of pedantic,
it's an upside down.
It's not really a tablet. It's not a tablet like this is a tablet. Yes. It is. It's basically a slate PC. I mean, it's a full Windows PC. So I wouldn't really kind of put it on the same. I mean, it's going to cost twice as much. It's going to do different things. It's not an iPad competitor. It's something different.
I see this as driving something else. One of the biggest trends that we're seeing in the enterprise right now is BYOD. So you've got all these different vendors trying to figure out how to let the users of a network bring the device that they want to bring. And that really what that means is smartphones and tablets.
But that happened with the iPhone. It's what transformed enterprise phones.
Exactly. And
killed RIM
It killed RIM. But also what you're seeing is that that's been eroding Microsoft's enterprise lead.
Right.
In that space. And
are they worried about the iPad becoming a dominant enterprise platform?
I think they are. And that's why you've got the Surface RT. Right. What they want to do is they want to offer an option for enterprise people to say, if you want a tablet, we can give you one without having to bring your own device. We can give you a tablet experience that stays within
this network that we've already created that uses all the same resources that we've already bought. So, I mean, I see that as the real impetus and why Microsoft released what was clearly an underbaked product. I mean, it. No one was able to play with
it. What was the hurry here? And it must have been Google I.O., right?
Yeah, definitely I.O.
Why I.O.?
Well, I mean, we don't know for sure what's going to be announced, but we keep hearing about new tablet stuff, and we assume they're going to show a new version of Android.
So not only is Microsoft terrified of Apple, they're terrified of Google.
Well, as well they should be. I mean, there isn't a legitimate player in the tablet space other than Apple right now. But if there was one, it would be Google. They're at least closer than the other guys, which are essentially non-existent.
I guess what I'm saying is I can't see Windows RT competing with the iPad.
Look, if you zoom way out, you know, we're at year three of tablets,
right. Basically.
And it feels
Unless
like
you
it
include
feels like
Microsoft's tablet efforts since 2001.
Which I don't, because again, those were PCs.
Right.
And they were built as PCs.
Right.
So it's a different paradigm.
Okay.
They didn't really know what to do yet. Nobody really knew what to do yet. They were dabbling. We're in year three of tablets. I think, you know, let's like zoom ahead 10 years, 15 years when tablets are, you know, what most of us are doing most of our basic computing on and have been for quite some time. That could look totally different. I think it's hard to say like way down the line.
You didn't bring a laptop. You decided to go tablet on. Are you doing
I brought a laptop. I didn't bring it.
You didn't bring it out.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So you're on the iPad only.
I really don't like being iPad only. It's not for me.
No.
If I could only pick one device, it would be my laptop.
Yep.
I feel very weird about, you know, going on vacation with only an iPad. It doesn't feel right. And there's a lot of stuff I know I can't do.
It's a stretch. You have to work extra hard. You have to bring a keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
Just bring a laptop for crying out loud, yeah. Right?
You've got a nice Air.
So. Ultrabooks and MacBook Airs. I mean, the MacBook Air, ironically, is not that much heavier than the iPad. And comes with a full keyboard and all the software you could possibly want. And there's some ultrabooks out there that are going to fit that bill. So I think that that for those of us that are doing real work, the laptop is still the machine of choice.
So here's the question, Robert. Microsoft's argument is, well, you're using Windows in business. You're using Exchange. You want compatibility. We're going to give you a Microsoft solution that's going to fit better into your enterprise than the iPad. Mm-hmm. But isn't that what BlackBerry said? You've got BlackBerry Enterprise Server. Isn't that what the Windows Phone 6 and 6.5 was all about? Well, it integrates better. It works with Office. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't compelling. When we got to the BYOD era, people brought iPhones. So Microsoft, I think, is counting on the idea that, well, we'll somehow integrate better into the enterprise.
Right. And that's absolutely key. And it's something that they have proven they haven't been able to do.
They haven't. Nobody
has. They had an incredible opportunity with the release of Windows Mobile to tightly integrate it with Exchange, to make it a no-brainer to be able to use in the enterprise. And it's not there. It's actually easier to set up an Android phone on Exchange Server than it is to set up Windows Mobile. And that's ridiculous.
Sync with Windows Phone.
Are you talking about Windows Mobile or Windows Phone? You're talking about Windows Phone.
Windows Phone now.
Windows because phone, Windows Mobile, that was the key feature of Windows Mobile back in the day up to 6.5 was that it had Exchange integration, and that wasn't enough to save it, right? So I think Microsoft probably looked at that and said, okay, well, clearly, you know, having a great Office-enabled product, an enterprise-enabled product is not what's going to save us. So we have to work towards the consumer first and then back our way into that. And I think that's actually what they're doing. They didn't really talk about the business story at this launch. I mean, they really didn't. It was very, very much a consumer-focused launch. And I think that's really important. We're talking a lot about business, but I don't think that this is intended to be a business product. I think if we're talking about BYOD, they want this to be a device that consumers feel comfortable with.
That's how the Apple...
Right. Which is, frankly, the strategy they should be taking.
Yeah.
But I like your analysis of looking at this as year three of tablets, because we could actually take it back. Look, 5 years. 5 years ago, everything was netbook. We were moving to the netbook. And then people realized, well, the netbook doesn't really have everything I want. Tablets became really popular. People are now using iPads alone, and they realize it doesn't have everything I want. And so you've got, on the other side, they're bringing out ultrabooks. And the Surface seems to be just an ultrabook with a touchscreen. So it looks as if Microsoft is betting the farm on a strategy that says people want devices that are going to be like a tablet, but will increasingly allow you to do more of the things you can expect out of a notebook.
I think
it might fill a very nice niche that way.
I think at least in the higher end, heavier version of the Surface, Microsoft is also betting that people want to run their Windows software. I mean, because there are certainly people who are out there who love their iPad but are frustrated because there's one or two PC or Mac programs that they simply can't run. And I do think that there is a market for that. But as is pointed out, Microsoft has more than 10 years experience coming out with tablets that are basically just little PCs. So the question is, by having the hybrid with a Metro interface and the desktop, by making it lighter, taking advantage of newer technology, can they finally crack that business market for people who want the tablet that also is a PC? They claim it's a great tablet and a great PC, but that really remains to be seen.
This rarely works. Every time you try to, you know, balance multiple disparate needs within the electronics world, it almost never works out. I mean, Microsoft has made it work once, and I would say the Xbox 360 is a great example that they created a game console that was also an amazing living room entertainment device. But, you know, that was something that took them years to slowly develop, and they're kind of really just now fleshing out that side. Like, they got the games down, and then they moved to the entertainment stuff over the course of, you know, 2-3 years.
I'm pointing to the one example where it's worked, the multifunction device.
That's true.
Printer, scanner, effect. And frankly, when those first came out, there was a lot of question about, pardon my camera here, there was a lot of questions about those too, because they weren't all that good. But that's about the only thing I can think of that really does multiple things well.
And that's where Apple has succeeded so well, is with this very clear laser-like focus. This is it. Don't look for a file system. You know, some people said, why didn't Apple think of putting a keyboard in the smart cover? They could have.
And they might still.
Or maybe not. Maybe, you know, that's not. Maybe they're thinking.
I mean, and that's kind of my point. Whether or not they do or they don't, I think it comes down to, you know, if you hedge too much, everything suffers. And at the end of the day, this is really about creating a great user experience.
It's designed by committee versus vision.
Right. And so I think Microsoft actually did show some vision here. And I mean, this could go a couple of ways. It could go Xbox or it could go Zune, right? It could be the dark horse success or it could totally belly flop.
Is it just those two? Is it very binary?
Those are our touchstones for Microsoft hardware products. So,
but there's quite a division between the Pro and the RT. I mean,
I think
the Pro is DOA. Products.
And by the way,
Pro is DOA, RT
really?
Maybe. Yeah.
Oh, so I was the other way around. You think Pro's dead?
I think Pro not a chance.
Nobody's going to buy that. It's a weird laptop.
Why would anybody buy that weird laptop for about $1,000 when you could go buy a MacBook Air?
Right.
I mean, or somebody explain that to me. It just makes no sense. Right. RT, I can see. It's going to be really hard for them, but I can actually see some people buying that and adopting it. The Pro just makes no sense. I mean, we've already seen Slate PCs do not sell. They're highly verticalized. You see them in the medical industry, and that's basically it. They don't move. Nobody cares about them. It's the worst of all worlds.
But you brought up a very important point. That's pricing. We still don't have pricing.
Right.
We're all assuming that because Microsoft said, it's going to be comparable to Ultrabooks, that we're looking at the $800 to $1,200.
Let's take a break, because let's talk about what we don't know. Because there's a lot we don't know, and there's a lot of missing things. I want to talk about the event. We're talking about Surface and a very big week for Microsoft. We haven't even gotten to Windows Phone 8, which they also announced this week. And we got the right guy for that with Ryan Block from Gadget, GT.com. On the enterprise side, we've got Father Robert Ballister. It's great. It's perfect time. And you see where Microsoft is in this weird hybrid world, right? And then Larry Magid and I also, who have to explain to consumers that there are two kinds of Windows, Windows RT and Windows 8 Pro. And how do you explain the difference, right? I hope you're enjoying. It's fun for me, actually. I don't usually watch This Week in Tech because I'm, you know, I was there. So I don't watch the show again. And it's fun for me to see these. Because it reminds me, what a fun show this is. What a great show we do. Thanks not so much to me, but to our producer, Chad Johnson, who puts this together. When did you start this year? When did Eileen Rivera did like the first half of the year, and Chad took over, and both of them did just such a great job putting these panels together. And our great panelists, people like John C. Dvorak, and Jolie O'Dell, and Alexia Tsotsis, and Harry McCracken, and Mike Elgin. I could just go on and on. We've probably had 2 or 3 dozen regular panelists throughout the year, and every one of them bringing something fabulous to the table. Ryan Block, Veronica Belmont, Joshua Topolsky, Nilay Patel from The Verge. Just wonderful people. Who else? Cory Doctorow joined us this year. It was so nice to have Cory. He's so rarely available for us. So
It's fun for me to go back through time and look at these old episodes. We're going to get an interesting one in just a second. The Matt Honan hack in a bit. But first, let me tell you about something that is not a hack that is absolutely fantastic. From Lantronics, the X-Print server. You know, I got a call today from a guy. It was so great. He said, I don't have a complaint. I don't have a problem. I just want to thank you for something. He says, I listen to the shows. I love the shows. This is on the radio show. And I try to buy your, you know, the products your sponsors advertise whenever I can. He says, I have a USB printer. I wanted to put it on the network. And you were talking about this Lantronics X-Print server. And I bought one. And he said, I just got one complaint. He said, I thought there'd be some installation, some configuration, some driver downloads. There was nothing. I just plugged it in and it worked. He said, this was too easy. X-Print server lets you print wirelessly from your iPad, your iPhone, your iPod Touch. It turns a USB printer into a network printer. If you've got network printers, it makes them work better, too. No need to print through apps, to install software, to email yourself documents for printing. You print natively right from the iOS menu. 4,000 printers are supported, all the big brands. And it's so easy because it automatically discovers and sets up all your printers, USB and network. You just open it, plug it in, and you're printing. Just like our caller said, nothing to install. Now, the Home Edition is normally $99 and supports up to 8 USB and 2 network printers. For most people, that's enough. We had a school administrator send us a note saying, I put this in my school network, and it found every printer in the whole school network. She probably used the Office Edition. That's $199, and that supports up to 8 USB and unlimited network printers. So it's a really great IT solution. You can find out more at xprintserver.com/twit. And when you use the offer code TWIT, you're going to save 20% off your order. So it's really affordable. xprintserver.com/twit. And when you buy at checkout, use the offer code TWIT to save. That's nice. They upped that one to save 20%. We thank Lantronics so much. One of our new advertisers on This Week in Tech. The name Matt Honan, I've known Matt for years. He is he writes for the Wired Gadget blog. I've, you know, been a fan of his. I think he's kind of been a fan of ours for a long time. We've certainly chatted. And I was so devastated, so sad, when he told the world he'd been hacked. I mean, badly hacked. They'd got into his Gmail. They'd stolen his Twitter account. And worse, they got into his iCloud account and used a feature of iCloud to delete everything on his iPhone, his iPad, and his MacBook Air. Matt was devastated, but I give him a lot of credit because he told the story. He explained what happened. He ended up talking to the hacker who did it. And we all learned, I think, a really valuable lesson thanks to Matt Honan and his willingness to share his mistakes, I guess. On the air. When that happened, it was the few days after it happened, we called Matt and we got a chance to talk to him on Twit. Here's what it sounded like. But before we get into the meat of the matter, I wanted to introduce Matt Honan. I've known Matt for quite some time. You might remember him from Gizmodo. And are you working for Wired now or are you just freelancer, Matt?
I am. I'm a full-timer at Wired now.
Full-timer at Wired. And I read an article that just terrified me, a blog post that you wrote on your blog about getting hacked. And it's you can read it at emptyage.com if you want to read the story. But I thought we'd get Matt on because I think it's a kind of morality tale for the cloud generation. What happened?
I think that there's several things that are interesting about it. We're all sort of increasingly relying on cloud services, and a lot of us, myself at least, tend to link accounts together, and both of those things, when combined, can make for some really dangerous situations.
So you had an iCloud account,
right?
You turned on a feature of iCloud, which I think is actually a useful feature. It's the remote wipe feature. So they've had for a while with the Find My iPhone. You could remote wipe a lost mm-hmm. iPhone. And they now have, and I think this is new in Mountain Lion, I don't remember it before, the ability to remote wipe a laptop.
It was certainly a Lion feature because I haven't upgraded to Mountain Lion on my MacBook yet. But yeah, and So what happened, if you're ready for me to get into it, what happened was Friday, I left work a little early and was home just before 5 o'clock. And I started playing with my daughter, and my phone died, or it looked like it died. And I went to go plug it in. And when I plugged it in, it started up to the screen, the start screen, like the initial start screen that you get when you first get a new iPhone. It says plug into iTunes. And I thought, oh, that's weird, but, you know, things happen. And I went downstairs to connect it to my Mac, because I'd backed up really recently to my desktop, and restore it from that backup. Oh, I'm sorry, I should say, when I tried to log into iCloud, it said my password was wrong. And I didn't think that much of it. I went downstairs, flipped open my MacBook, and it almost instantly went to a gray screen and asked for a PIN to log in, a four-digit PIN. And at that point, I knew I had real problems. And what turned out that had happened was that someone had hacked into my iCloud account using basically social engineering techniques, and they were able to remote wipe my iPhone, iPad, and MacBook. And because I'm a terrible computer user, I hadn't backed up my MacBook in a really long time.
Well, and you did something else bad, which was you had iCloud as your password recovery for both Gmail and Twitter.
Actually, just Gmail. So that was, yeah, that really exasperated things. So what happened next was that the chronology of events was basically, and I've been in touch with the person who hacked into my account. They were ultimately trying just to get my Twitter. They just wanted my...
Because you had the Gizmodo Twitter account.
They weren't even trying to get to the Gizmodo Twitter account.
They just wanted Matt.
They just wanted Matt. The Gizmodo Twitter account was just a bonus. They didn't even realize it was connected until they got into mine. At some point, you can link Twitter accounts. And so at some point, when I worked at Gizmodo, I had linked my Twitter account with Gizmodo's Twitter account so I could, you know, not have to log in and log out every time from the web. Right. And that hadn't been undone since I left.
Even though you had left Twitter. I mean, Gizmodo, yeah.
Right, yeah. So I was still linked. They didn't actually have password-level access to the Gizmodo Twitter account. They just had password-level access to my Twitter account. So what they did was they used a social engineering technique to get to my iCloud account. They used my .Mac email as the backup email for Gmail, got into my Gmail, and then used Gmail as the account verification for Twitter, and got into my Twitter account.
Wow.
Now, you did a few things wrong, and there's going to be pedantic people I know in our chat room who said, well, if you had only done this, this, and this, and of course, but this is the kind of thing we're all doing, and this is kind of the reason I think it's a morality tale. You at first thought your password maybe had been hacked or brute forced.
Right. Yeah, that was my initial suspicion. I mean, I just thought that, you know, I had a seven-digit alphanumeric password, and...
That's pretty weak.
I've had it for years, yeah, and that's pretty weak. And like, I just haven't changed it in years out of laziness. I don't use it anywhere else, but that's not a good password. I mean, most of my passwords, I use one password, and most of my passwords now, the new password generator, you know, 15 characters, 16 right. characters. And so I thought, okay, well, someone, you know, used some sort of technique to crack my password. A lot of other people were speculating that someone had set up some sort of intercept to you know, a keystroke logger or something. But as it turned out, both the hacker told me and Apple subsequently verified, Apple Tech Support verified with me, someone called Apple Tech Support at 4:30 on Friday, or about 4:30 on Friday, claimed to be me, knew some details, knew enough details, and was able to have a temporary password issued.
Oh.
When the temporary password was issued, they were able to log into iCloud and completely change the password. And that was kind of step one. Step two was wiping all my stuff so that I couldn't go in and stop them. And step three was going into my Gmail and getting my Twitter. Step four was they deleted my Google account. And then they just went crazy on my Twitter account for several hours Friday evening.
You say the hacker contacted you. How do you know it's him or her?
I should say I'm not positive that it's him or her, but they've given me details they've given me enough details, including some account details, that I know that if it wasn't the person who actually did it, that the person was certainly involved in it. They know stuff that something right. that someone else wouldn't be able to tell me.
And they were targeting your Twitter account. That was what this whole thing was about, was so they could put stuff on your Twitter account.
They told me, the guy said, we just want your Twitter account. We just did it for, it's not, he said, we didn't have anything personal against you.
You've got that account back.
I do have that account. I've got now all my accounts back, and Apple has my MacBook. I mean, the big priority for me is recovering my data. I've got a young child, and I just hate thinking of all the pictures that I would use if I lost all my data.
No kidding. Anybody have any questions for Matt?
Well, I mean, what did they put up on your Twitter account?
Crap. Was it spam? Why were they trying to make money off of it? What were they?
Was it for the lulz?
Links to some YouTube videos, links to some other exploits they'd done, some, you know, basically racist, homophobic statements,
So you were just someone with a bunch of followers, and they wanted a platform to yell and scream like idiots.
I think basically, yeah, and they liked that it was a three-letter Twitter account.
Ah.
It's my account of my name.
It's at M-A-T. Which means you joined Twitter very, 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 very early.
I guess so.
And made yourself a target.
I've got a question here.
Yes, Ed.
Matt, do you feel in some sense, I know this might be a slightly insensitive question to ask, but do you feel lucky in a way that these guys weren't evil and malicious and skillful enough to hide their tracks for days or weeks while they mined your information and maybe tried to social engineer some of your contacts?
Certainly. Absolutely. 100%. I mean, the first thing I did was call, before I even realized that my Gmail had gotten hacked, first thing I did was call Apple. And I was on the phone with their tech support department for a very long time. And I kept telling them, I got to get off the phone and call my bank. Because I mean, I was really worried that they were immediately going to go into my, you know, online bank. Once you get into somebody's email, you can get everything. And I was worried they were going to go into my online banking, go into, you know, any number of other accounts, and just clean me out. That was my big concern at the time.
But you also have, I mean, you have, I'm sure, a very impressive address book.
Patrick just changed his Twitter password
for the second time in 24 hours.
I think
hours.
You're not alone. I think there's people listening right now who are all furiously. First thing I did when I heard this is I put turn on two-factor authentication on my Google account. But go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Ed. Go ahead.
That's okay. So you must have a pretty impressive address book with, you know, contacts that if somebody wanted to social engineer, you know, people you know, people at Apple, people at Google, people, you know, people who are your sources, they could do a fair amount of damage, and they could actually use exploits and install keyloggers on those people's machines. So in a sense, I mean, as a wake-up call goes, this is a very painful and ugly one, but the damage is hopefully contained in a way that it wouldn't have been if somebody had been truly malicious and evil.
Yeah, it was certainly a wake-up call to me. I hadn't, to be honest, considered, you know, using social exploits to get to other people for my account. I hate to say it, but I just keep thinking I'm kind of lucky because it really could have been a lot worse. I mean, I'm really distraught about my data possibly being lost, but in the grand scheme of things, it was not. I mean, it could have been so much worse.
I'm just puzzled that Apple. I don't understand how Apple could have been tricked.
I'm not quite ready to. I'm probably going to reveal this in the Wired story tomorrow. I've got an email into Apple about this, and I want to give them both a chance to respond and to fix this. But there's some information that you can know about someone's account that lets you bypass having to answer the security questions.
So there's a flaw in their system.
I mean, I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's not information that's easy to get. I mean, I don't think I could have gotten it.
I got the impression from the message the hacker sent you that he knew of this flaw, that he was exploiting a known flaw.
Yeah, that's the impression that I have as well. I mean, I have the impression that this was there were the my understanding is that there are multiple people involved in this, and they had multiple areas of expertise. The guy who I've been in touch with, and I've only been in touch with one person. This apparently was his area of expertise.
Matt, did you get a sense that beyond just being a person with a three-letter Twitter account, that they knew who you were?
I got actually the sense that they did not know who I was.
So you were—it was just—it could be Ray or Joe on Twitter. It was just three letters. That's why they targeted you.
That's my impression. I mean, that's what I've—that's what they have said to me. I mean, you know, I don't know. How do you know?
And you and what are you doing now to protect? Obviously, you've got backup from now on.
Well, I disabled Find My iPhone and Find My iPad.
I'm looking at my iCloud. You can erase my desktop computer. If you can erase my computer at home. You can remote wipe any of these computers that are on currently. You just press that remote wipe button. If you got in my iCloud, you could wipe. Don't click that, Patrick.
Leo, something that happens when you do that is that it initiates a 4-digit PIN, okay? And only the person who presses that button gets to see that 4-digit PIN. So if I'm on the other end, if you're on the other end and someone does that, you don't really have any way to stop it. And this is one of the things that I think really ought to be fixed about that situation is that, you know, if there's going to be a PIN code, it ought to be something that you set up, or there ought to be a second password, there ought to be something that lets the person basically stop this in their tracks, or that at least, you know, has some sort of, you know, secondary level of authentication before you can pull a trigger and remotely wipe a hard drive. I mean, it's wiping a Mac. You know, I kind of gradually got into this. I had to find my iPhone set up, and then I was like, oh, well, I can do the same for my Mac. And that's actually quite different than wiping an iPhone.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot more data on there.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like that ought to have better security.
That'd be harder to do. Matt, I'm sorry this happened to you, but in a way, I'm really glad that it happened to you and that the world now knows because of who you are. And I think this is it's a wake-up call. I think Ed, you said it right. It's a wake-up call for everybody. And I hope that watching this, everybody is now going to secure their systems best you can.
I mean, would you turn off the iCloud? Would you turn off obviously you've turned off the Find My iPhone or wipe my computer. Would you suggest everyone do that at this point?
If you're backing everything up, I mean, see, this is somewhere where I really screwed up, right? I mean, is that I wasn't backing up I wasn't backing up my Mac regularly. I back up my desktop Mac every day. But I had not backed up my MacBook in a long, long time.
That's interesting. And, so you were backing up, it's just that one you didn't back. And I think a lot of us who have multiple computers kind of assume, well, everything's propagating. I'm fine.
Yeah, that was sort of what I mean, you know, I just gotten lazy. And so would I recommend that everybody turn off Find My iPhone? No. But Find My Mac, I mean, I actually probably would turn that off.
You know where your Mac is.
I know you know where it is. Yeah, I mean, it's like what somebody asked me, like, what's the greater risk? Is it actually having your Mac physically taken from your possession, or having someone be able to get into it electronically? And I think it's probably the greater risk, the more likely risk for a lot of people with a Mac. It's not a phone. Is having it broken into electronically.
If you can't find your desktop computer, I think you have bigger problems.
I understand maybe you thought it got stolen, blah, 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 but that's not that likely. I also think that we learned a lesson about where to send password recovery emails and to have kind of a rotating set of emails, not have them all sent to one place. The hacker obviously knew that if he did these erasures, it would be very hard for you to get everything back.
Yeah, obviously. And I gather they sort of backtracked. Like, they started with Twitter and found that, okay, well, my Twitter is linked to my Gmail. And then when they realized that my Gmail was linked to .Mac as the backup there, as the verification there, it was sort of like a jackpot moment for them. Having that all linked together was also a bad idea, and it's also something I've changed. I've set up two-factor authentication on my Gmail.
That's a pain, by the way. I did it, too, as soon as I read your story, and that's a pain.
I used to have to do it for work-related emails, and I always thought it was a pain, but you know what? I'm doing it now.
Yep. You have to run Google Authenticator on your phone. You can authenticate Google's stuff pretty easily. You just add that second factor. But then apps that don't know about two-factor authentication, you have to get a special password generated from Google and enter both passwords.
It's a trade-off. Security at best is imperfect. There is no patch for human stupidity. Multi-billion. No. And that's not for you, Matt. Apple's got more money than just about any corporation in North America, and they allowed somebody to social engineer their way into locking at you out of your digital life. That's bad. Whether that was a failure between the keyboard and the chair by whoever was answering the phone, or whether that was, you know, a massive flaw in the way they institute the system, which I think we'll probably find more out in your Wired article tomorrow. But
I can't wait. Yeah.
You know, that scares the delete expletive out of me.
Yep.
That sucks, dude. And I'm sorry you went through this.
I've for a long time, I used to write about this. I wrote a few pieces about this for Gizmodo, but I really feel like password systems in general. I mean, passwords are just a broken system. I mean, just using passwords are a terrible system. I know there are a lot of smart people working on other options. We don't have them yet. And you know, I mean, the ultimate failure point here was this temporary password that was issued. And I mean, this has reinforced every bad feeling I have about our password-based authentication systems.
What would you suggest? I mean, eyeballs or what? I'm curious.
Yeah,
what are the solutions?
I don't know. I mean, I think there might be some browser-based solutions for web logins, but generally speaking, I don't know. You know, and I've talked to people in the U.S. government about that. Even I know that the president has actually set up a special office where they're looking at sort of working on next-generation password things, but. You know, one of the big problems is that Microsoft is working on one thing and Google is working on another and Apple is working on another and Facebook's working on another and everybody sort of has a vested interest in being identity providers. And that means that, you know, you don't get some sort of top-down standard.
This gets really important, too, as we start doing virtual money and things like that, because really all a financial transaction is about is authenticating the two parties. And if you don't have good authentication systems, and we are moving full speed ahead towards digital financial transfers,
and you know, and all due respect to any PayPal employees in the audience, we all know that with large multinational banks make a mistake, it's your fault,
right?
Yeah. We're going to lock you out of your account forever.
I like second factor authentication. I think that's a good start, and I think. Sending a 4-digit passcode to a cell phone one-time use or having something like Google Authenticator or the Blizzard Authenticator give you these rotating numbers, I think that's a pretty good start.
I'm going all cash.
You'd have to steal my phone and steal my password.
I'm going straight barter from here on out.
Matt, we're going to let you go. Stuff. Thank you. Matt Honan, I'm sorry that happened to you.
Yeah, if you're Thanks, going so. All cash, I'll be at your house this week.
Yeah, which is safer, right? Your mattress or your cell phone?
You know, nothing is safe. Nothing's Life is safe. Not safe.
There you go. Acceptable risk.
It's guys.
Best to own nothing. Thank you, Matt Honan.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you,
Matt.
Take care. Maybe you go home on Wednesday, right? Instead of wait until Thursday, that kind of thing.
And you could probably chime in via that iPad mini of yours.
There you go.
Ho-ho.
Speaking of the mini, it's here. Came on Friday. Apparently sold out already.
Sold out already, yes.
But
apparently
that's,
you could get one in Stockton. Do you know where is Stockton?
Not far from here. Let's go.
California.
Road trip.
I had a O'Malik had to go and send, had to go and get one in Stockton. He was having such a hard time. Yeah.
He wanted one that bad.
He was like, I think I'm going to wait. And I was like, you're not going to wait. Just get it. And he's like, okay, I'm going to get it.
But all you need now is the Wi-Fi, black or white.
Black or white, yep. Or you can spray paint it.
You got the
wait,
black
there's no 3G.
With a white.
There's 3G, but that comes at the end of the month. So I have the black one here.
With the white cover.
Just couldn't wait. So I have to say, I've never believed that the iPad was a mobile device. It's too heavy.
Heavy.
It's too big.
Yeah.
It's like it's a second laptop. It just doesn't have a keyboard.
That's because you're a welterweight.
Because he has a MacBook Air 11-inch. Bar fighting.
As do we all.
But I,
really?
This is like the
look
first.
At the, no, look. What? These three, look, we have the same
3-11. Oh, I thought you were talking about something else.
I was talking about the thing I just said. I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm sorry. It's okay. Get this
I
man
my hopes
drink.
Up briefly. Yeah.
But the
I thought just hanging out with you would help, but I guess not.
Continue, Jarvis.
Yeah, I'm going to continue on the 7.9 inch device. Yeah. Yeah. Device.
Much more realistically sized.
Yeah, much more realistically. Or for you, there's the iPhone.
It's 5 inches now.
It's smart.
Four?
Yeah,
it's
four.
Really?
Yeah, it was 3.9.
I always liked to, you know, that optical inch, the extra optical inch. But anyway, that's another matter.
Depends on the weather.
So I really like this thing. I mean, sure, it doesn't have the Retina display, and I feel like that was kind of a cheap shot because they could have easily put it in.
Because they clearly put it in the phone. Why would you de-retinize?
The phone and the iPad. The Touch.
Yeah.
But it's,
well,
what do you think of yours?
Is they wanted to compete on price, right? With the against the
yeah,
the
but that's
Nexus
7,
that's a mistake.
Right? I think it's a mistake.
Apple never wants to compete on price, do they? Really?
It's interesting. Nick and I both independently came to the same conclusion, which was that Apple has deferred. You wrote an article about this.
So wait, it's planned obsolescence.
They deferred an 8-megapixel camera and a Retina display in this thing. They could have easily included it because they want to do it. They want something for next
year.
They're
going to do it 6 months from now.
Right. Exactly. And so what it is, it's planned obsolescence. So planned obsolescence was developed in the 1940s or 50s with cars.
IBM used to do it. They would hold back innovation, stagger step them out in the 50s with mainframe computers because they wanted to sell new models. Cars, same thing. Fins.
Cars, the catalogs. It was the fins. So they did larger fins and smaller fins.
So what's the timing on when this gets a real display?
I think it's going to be September. Yeah, it'll be in the fall from
a year.
But
here's they'll sell 10 million or whatever it is. But it's just
my general take was Apple should not have. I think you're right, Brian. I think that they were somewhat aware of the low end, but look what happened. Google came out and said, okay, we'll take $50 off the Nexus 7. The problem is you cannot compete at the low end because neither Google nor Amazon has the same business model as Apple.
Correct.
Google makes money when you use it. Amazon makes money when you use it. Apple makes money when you buy it.
So when I covered the release of the Kindle HD, and I spoke to Bezos.
That's what he said.
And he said, I don't care if you have the first Kindle in your drawer or this Kindle. He's like, we just care if you buy books and if you buy media from us. Whereas for Apple, they care if you have the newest device.
It's the hardware. It's the margin
on
the hardware.
They probably make some money on the ecosystem after the fact, but mostly it's on
the hardware. Here's the question for the crew. What's more important in the long run? Is it going – because I'm kind of fed up buying new Apple devices. Yeah.
Starting to happen is there's going to be some fatigue. I think the 5 is the beginning of that. This thing maybe as well.
So in the long run, is Amazon have a better business model because they're based on the media, not the device?
Now, in my opinion, the Amazon Kindle Fire HD, which I've used extensively, is not very good.
Okay. I agree. It's a bad UI.
Yeah. The Nexus 7, on the other hand, is extremely competitive. It's $200 for 16 gigabytes. It's got a higher res screen. The only thing lacking, it doesn't have a rear-facing camera. I think most people don't care about that.
Yep.
And so my recommendation was not to buy the Mini. If price is an issue, get the Nexus 7.
The Nexus 7 is a wonderful, wonderful device.
And I think Apple should have, and I think you and I both before the show agreed to this, not have said we're going to make a competitive low-price product. We're going to make a small iPad, and we're going to charge whatever we need to charge to make it a Retina
display. Maybe like an iPad Mini.
Like an iPad Mini.
Mega Mini.
Now, do you think that they would have been better off if they had offered, because the press event was obviously, it was a heavy focus on the iPad Mini and then a minor focus on the latest revision of the iPad. I almost feel like the fact that they tried to pull this, as they're very good at in general, this breathless new innovation, something you've always wanted for essentially what's a mushy middle product. It's something that pretty much just bridges the gap between your cell phone and an iPad. I think they would have been better off if they played it down as an afterthought, you know, focus more on the new iPad revisions and then say, BT Dubs, people seem to like smaller devices, so we made one of those for you too, if you're interested. Then they could have charged $100 more and nobody would have complained.
Mm. That's not Apple's way, though.
Somebody just said on the thread they feel bad for Apple. It's $650 billion.
A good idea.
I mean, they have $121 billion in cash in the bank.
Sympathies are misplaced.
They could buy Greece. What's to feel bad for?
That's the answer to your question. You were asking whether or not Amazon had the better business model. Clearly not. Otherwise, they would be in Apple's place.
Yeah, but I remember for years.
He said in the long run
In the long run. Because I remember for years we said, whose wallet would you rather have, Steve Jobs or Bill Gates? Right. Bill Gates had a model where Microsoft paid very little for, software's free. They don't have to, and they charged a lot of money. But as time went by, Apple's business model actually turned out to be the better business model.
And I think part of the choice is, are there limited... is there a declining marginal return on the awesomeness of the hardware beyond which you're just not impressed anymore?
Well, that's what's happening.
And then
what is the thing, the thread between all these devices? They're rectangles.
Yeah.
And what's going to happen is they're just going to get thinner and thinner and thinner, and that's it.
So when do we stop caring about the specs? And then on the second term,
well, we already do.
If it's a service issue, who's got the better ecosystem? Am I locked
in?
That's
what it comes down to. Is the
three
screens.
iTunes, to my account, to the wallet they have, to the investment I've already made in my TV subscriptions there, or am I tied into Amazon because of my book relationship with them and my shipping relationship, my Amazon Prime? Or is it to Google with their burgeoning thing?
Okay, so that's really interesting because I am tied into Amazon with my books because it works on any device.
Same.
Apple, I don't buy books from because it works on Apple devices.
No, but I do buy most of my TV through Apple.
Yes, but that's because it's a one-time thing, right? It's I watch it once. You don't save your TV shows and watch them later.
No, that's true. But yeah, books are Kindle.
So things that you want for an extended period of time, you're going to go with the brand that allows you to do that. Things that you want immediately, you'll go with that.
And music, I go with neither.
I do predict, though,
services,
that we're going to hear record sales numbers for the iPad Mini.
Of course.
I
mean, Absolutely.
So what are we saying? We're not saying that it's not going to be
saying,
a success.
What we're saying is, what I believe is, I bought this cable here, right?
And that's driving me crazy.
This is a fire
lightning
cable to USB. $29 yeah. effing dollars, okay? Yeah. Seriously, screw you guys. Because this thing costs 50 cents to make, because you know what? Every single one of these cables that comes out, there's a third party that makes them, and they cost
$0.50. These have authentication chips, and so they are more expensive.
Okay, 56 cents.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Right? I mean, at the
that's
scale,
a huge difference. That's like more than 10% difference.
But as a customer...
Go ahead.
As a customer, it's annoying. It's like completely frustrating and disrespectful.
And because Apple did have to move everybody from that 30-pin connector, they should have really charged cost for these, at least to make up for the fact that you're going to have some pain. You're going to have to buy a bunch.
Exactly.
And I've spent $200 on Lightning cables.
I have too.
It's really frustrating.
And I think that it's not fair to the customer. I really, truly believe it's not.
But it's not hurting Apple's bottom line.
I know.
Fairness of the customer is ultimately measured in sales.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes and no. I mean, there's a long term and the short term. In the short term, of course, they're making money hand over fist, but they're eroding their long term brand value.
Yeah,
this is the cashing in. This is what you see. This is
I gotta say, they've been doing this historically. Remember how much Apple charged for RAM? They stopped doing that, but they used to charge five times what RAM cost when you bought a Mac with more RAM.
Yeah.
Hurt them, did it, Brian?
Well, I mean, again, it's tough to say right now. I mean, it's in a post-Jobs era, it's very difficult to know whether or not any of these things are chipping away to what extent. But, you know, in many ways, brands tend to get to the top of their game and then they begin to cannibalize themselves because they can't resist taking advantage of all the power they have, not realizing that for all the money they get, they are chipping away at their value.
Absolutely.
Well, and you saw that, you know, so you see with the cables. You saw it with Maps, which was a forced downgrade to many of its users. Would you have been led to expect a certain service level, and then they violated that trust and that expectation? So.
Yeah, in
so
fact, I talked to somebody on an iPhone 4 on the radio show today, and she, as you would normally do, installed iOS 6 because Apple said, you should install the new update.
Why would you not?
And all of a sudden, it took away features.
Yeah, upgrades don't decline.
She was very upset. It shouldn't reduce the value. Quite reasonably so.
Yeah. And I don't know if we actually put this in our story, but... I'm going to break some news here.
Exclusive.
So exclusive on Twit. So apparently Johnny is a big fan of – I mean, he thinks that the Windows Phone 8 design is actually quite nice, right? And I think it is. I agree.
It is what we call digital native.
Yeah.
It no longer refers back to
Why
any
lock
pre
it into
non-digital
history. And Scott stuff. Apparently thought it was crap. There was that, and then there was a lot of the stuff that happened with Apple Maps, and apparently there was a big meeting with the execs, and they wanted to put out an apology, and Tim Cook asked Scott to sign it, and Scott refused, which is what we reported. Mm. And Scott also just didn't play well with others.
Now, old Malik said, I couldn't get any of my sources to confirm that this was the issue, but...
Which part?
The part about signing the letter.
I think that was one of them, but there's been a lot of tension.
It makes sense, though. You're the CEO. You want this apology. You're going to do this apology. And when you're forced to sign it yourself because the guy responsible for iOS said, no, I am not signing it. Here's an example. This is this photo booth in Snow Leopard, which is fairly clean and simple. Here's photo booth in Lion.
Oh, it's
got red velvet curtains.
Exactly.
It's got
that always irritates me. And Game Center.
So what's
Game Center's
awful.
Green beige.
It makes me not want to have fun.
Game Center looks like Zynga designed
to have fun.
It's totally
unfunds me. In Scott's defense, Scott single-handedly, you know, was one of the people that put iOS where it is today. There are hundreds of millions of people on hundreds of millions of devices.
You know, people point to Siri and Maps as a debacle, but everything else has been hugely successful.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what happened when Steve was running the company, you can ask Walter Isaacson, you know, Adam Leshinsky, all these guys that have written books on this. When Steve was running the company, he enjoyed and he liked and he promoted the tension within the company.
He wanted that.
He wanted that because it created a creative force. And I think it worked.
Like
when
Lincoln.
You have people that are like, skeuomorphic's amazing, and people are like, it sucks.
It works when you have a dictator
correct.
Who can say, you're right, we're going to do it this way.
Right.
But if there's nobody with that strong leading it, it's very
and so divisive. So when Steve left, there was a giant power vacuum at Apple.
And which I stepped.
I would love to see you.
I'm actually the guy behind the curtain.
One of the stories was that Scott was very preening and grooming himself to be the next CEO. He, yes. Nobody else thought this, but he thought he should be the
he
next
thought,
CEO.
And I've heard this from several sources, very senior people too, and other people have reported it, you know, he believed that he should have been CEO, not Tim. And
so there's a problem right there.
And I think there's a problem right there. And I think that, you know, and the thing with Scott, the thing with Scott was, I mean, we
in the game of Apple, you become CEO or you die.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's probably true.
That's good. I love Schwood.
But what, I mean, Schwood. When I interviewed Walter Isaacson, I did a Q&A with him after the book came out. And one of the things that he said that really stuck out with me was Steve Jobs was, he was, there was half of him that was this creative genius and there was half of him that was this technical genius, if you will, right? And there was also problems. He's not the greatest guy ever, but that was the gist of it. And when you take Tim Cook and Johnny Ive and you put those two together, they are that. So Johnny is the creative genius, Tim is the business genius, and they together make what essentially Apple was with Steve Jobs. Right.
Well, and that's what you have now, because Johnny Ive, this is the first time at Apple that I can remember somebody being in charge of everything. He's in charge of human interface design across all products.
Which makes sense.
Oh, yeah, I think actually. So, too. Makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think that you'll start to see a much more beautiful and consistent user interface that spans every single part of the OS.
Eddie Q, who analogs. Was the iTunes guy, is now responsible for software across the board. Now, do you think Scott needed to go? I mean, what is your sense of it? There were reports, I think it was in your story, in fact, that people were celebrating. They were going to the bars and saying, ding dong, the witch is dead when he was fired.
Yeah, there was somebody that said it's better than the Giants winning. That was a source. Which is, that's saying a lot, yeah. You know, coming from someone in California.
There's one thing that really surprised me in the media coverage of this is people were saying, you know, Maps was amiss. But then they listed Siri as a black eye. And I've never thought of Siri. I'm somebody who's on the road, always behind the wheel or riding my bike. I use Siri nonstop. And I find it, in general, really good, and I was surprised that we didn't hear more Siri talk at the last.
I'll tell you why Siri is a failure. First of all, they bought a program, Siri, that did more than Siri does even today. It never got out of beta. The network has been highly unreliable. So I don't know about you, Brian, but don't you find that at least some large percent of the time you try to communicate with Siri, she comes back saying, "I'm sorry, I can't help you."
And
right
it's
now.
Not just a 3G thing; it's Wi-Fi too.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's
Siri's network, not us.
Yes.
Yeah.
When it happens, it almost exclusively is because of connectivity issues, not because she misinterprets what I'm saying.
No, it's not. And I think that that's a common misconception that you're having connectivity issues. It's North Carolina. It's their data center is not responsive. And I know that because it happens here when we have
so
very good
you
connectivity.
You don't think it's a matter of the consumer product not being appreciated. You think it's a case where the infrastructure is not strong enough, and that's why they're not continuing to build on it?
I believe that's part of the problem. I don't know. Maybe Nick knows better what the thinking is inside Apple. But Siri should be out of beta by now. Siri should be better than it is by now. It's just now
Siri,
getting as
you
good
should
as it
be able to download personality.
It.
You should be able to download different personalities. You
I want mine to be the Knight Rider car.
You want a kit to my Siri.
I would pay for that.
If you look at go back to All Things D when they demoed Siri before it was purchased as Siri, before it was purchased by Apple, and there was these great things where you could say, you know, what are the five biggest lakes in California? You know, what's the temperature in South Dakota compared to the temperature in North Carolina?
It's a very
and they stripped all these
product.
Things out, and I think that, you know, if they're going to do it in beta, do it in beta. Like, throw everything in there and let us, like, have fun and play with it.
Yeah.
Or strip it out and say it's not in beta or whatever it is that you need to do.
I would guess, Brian, that your good experience with Siri is because you have limited severely what you try to do with it.
Yeah. I mean,
you know what Siri's going to do well and what she's not going to do well.
Right, right. And I guess part of that, you know, it's very compartmentalized. You could do the parlor trick of asking, you know, what's the mass of Jupiter? And it calls up, you know, the stuff from Wolfram Alpha. Right. But for sending texts, I very rarely have her dictate texts to me. But when I'm out on my bike, I mean, there's nothing I got hands on the handles. I'm not able to do anything. And it's a big pain in the butt to pull out the phone. So I use it a lot for that. And there are times I send out texts. I'm like, it's close enough. Sure,
actually,
whatever.
I do that all the time. And sometimes some wonderful autocorrect.
Sending death threats by accident.
Yeah. That's different. That's nuance. That's the nuance dictation. That's actually something different. And it's not something Apple developed.
My failure has been, there's a certain level of, there's a certain service level that I expect. And when it fails, then my trust in the system is degraded. So I just, it becomes binary for me. If it doesn't work, 98%+ of the time, it works 0% of the time.
Exactly.
And so when I will dictate a query or a transcription and it pings the server and gives me little beautiful purple dots and then comes back with zero. And I've just dictated a whole paragraph and it's gone. It's
I'm getting really sick of those dots.
I never did anything. Yeah. It's like I just did work. It's your turn. Like, it's a partnership.
Anyway, I think it's reasonable to say it isn't widely acknowledged that Siri is a flop. And the fact that
everybody's saying
Scott Forstall's flops, Maps and Siri. Mm. I understand what you're saying, Brian. It's like, well, really, was Siri such a flop?
Well, I'll tell you what, man, it's something that I've wanted. I mean, if you go back to listening to one of my first appearances on This Week in Tech, it was like all I wanted was that microphone button on the keyboard so that I could start voice dictation. And it took years for it to get there. And now that it's here, I'm thrilled. But,
I would say he was not fired over Maps and Siri.
No, I think
it was convenient, but that's not what.
Yeah, I think it was just it was everything. It was and I think that there was really a power vacuum going on in Apple, and there still will be, and there still is. You know,
we've seen this before. Remember, Google did a reorganization, and somebody was left out of that—a woman named Marissa Meyer.
Yeah, exactly. She was pushed down very far.
Yeah, it's not unusual, especially with a new CEO, in this case Larry Page, in this case Tim Cook, to come in and put a stamp on a company, say these are the people I trust. Yep. This is how I'm going to, and the organization is going to be a little bit different because I'm not Steve Jobs.
Correct. And Apple, of course, wants to make sure that people know that it is run by Tim Cook.
That's really bottom line.
That makes sense.
That's the
You gotta. He's got to sacrifice some. This is what every new king has to come in and establish dominance.
Well, there's another
and sacrificing, you know, a high ranking member of the family to make
and
to
now
make
you're
it clear.
Tyrion Lannister on us. that the buck stops. Like this. Like, exactly. Sorry, bro. Some heads got to roll.
You got to always pay your debts.
All right.
And you
so, what,
kill
so let's
somebody.
Let's do a little foreshadowing here. So Scott Forstall, you know, he ran a very large part of an organization at one of the biggest companies in the world.
Oh, he works for me now.
Where does he go now? What is next for Scott Forstall? Is he going to develop the next lighting company? Because, you know, based on skeuomorphic design.
Do you like Hue?
Hue.
Philips Hue?
I don't know what you're talking about.
What do we think?
Philips has created it's very expensive, $200 for 3 light bulbs. But you have to get a kit that attaches to your Ethernet.
Jeez.
And controls the light bulbs. You could take a picture of something with your iPhone and say, I want this color. It's
the
their
Hue?
RGB light bulbs, and they will change the room to the color of the thing. I take a picture of you, Baritone. Yeah. My room is dark.
The Hue Philips.
So what's the point of this?
Because
you can then have any
atmosphere. Because then your room can look like Baritone.
Well, I mean, obviously, the nation and the world have been clamoring for this for decades. But outside of that single, you know, world-establishing
use case.
I think
it's very interesting. It's a little pricey, but the idea that you could program any color in your lights and control it with your iPhone. I'm not selling you. Never mind.
I'm low on the list of demands in my life. Like, this room has the wrong light.
Next time I bring a girl back to my place, and she's like, it's so nice in here.
It is an essential tool for single men. Nick and I are going to run this now. Hue lighting. Yes.
But you could sell that.
How is Hue spelled, actually?
H-U-E. It's on the Apple Store. Philips. Search for Philips with one L.
What?
Philips
Hue. Because, the thing is I can't get the lighting on these lights in the studio right, so I always end up looking pinker when I'm here. And, of course, they make fun of me incessantly in the chat room. But when I'm there in the studio, I look normal. But here I look like a pink monster. So I'm going to get these.
I've ordered it, but these are 3 months out. But the reason I know about this is we use RGB lights here. They're very expensive professional lighting. But we can make the backdrop, for instance, any color that we want. It's purple right now. I can switch it to blue. There you go.
Speaking of lost me, I'm literally checking my email right now.
Can you do Baritone, Chad?
I do not like email.
Chad's going to see if he can do Baritone.
Look at more things in my
email. He's working on it.
So I'm gonna.
You realize there's no way for Chad to do anything and not get in serious trouble for it.
Are we having a racial moment?
No, I think we are.
Is it time to take over the show
again? I think it's time. So, Leo, don't you have a flight to catch or something like that?
This worked out very well last time.
I want to go to
Occupy Twit. Is back.
Occupy Twit. You did that last time.
We did Occupy Twit. That was amazing.
We could do that. After I do the last commercial, I'll get up and leave.
Okay, cool.
And you're in charge.
And should we debate the elections?
I want to go back.
You're voting for Romney. We know already that you're for Obama.
I'm going to make the case that you should not vote. The only way to throw away your vote is to vote. And so I recommend, if you're in a lost state where it's already decided.
Whoa, Ryan, have you ever
I am going to write in Scott Forstall on my ballot.
You know who's on the California ballot? I don't know if she's on anybody else's. We got Roseanne Barr on our ballot.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah. Peace and Freedom Party.
There you go.
No, Ryan, that's the tragedy of the commons. That's a common fallacy.
And actually, I'm working on a project right now. So I you know, as you know, and some, most people know, I left The Onion some months ago and started a company.
And we miss you.
So I'm now an entrepreneur, and it's called Cultivated Wit. We do comedy tech projects, and we're doing this thing with Ford Foundation.
As long as you don't call it quit, I'm okay.
It's definitely not going to be called that. So we're
you working for Forbes?
Ford Foundation is
Ford,
a client.
Ford, wow.
And we're doing this comedic shaming of non-voting friends.
Thank you. Shame him now.
So shame on you, Schwood.
Shame on you. Keep in mind.
I can't even hear you because I'm so full of shame
right
now.
First of all, everyone should know and vote on all of their local issues.
Thank you.
And nobody does. Everyone votes in the one election
because it's so confusing. What is Prop 1274
B9? Oh, it's so confusing to operate a supercomputer in my hand every day.
I'm going
to
show you guys the one site you need to know.
Okay. We're about to get schooled here.
This is just the one site you need to know. You've heard of Wikipedia. This is Ballotpedia, ballotpedia.org.
Uh-huh.
Go to your state. For instance, the ballot measures, Nick, you're saying in California. Yes, very confusing. Click on California ballot measures. They list them all. They list what they say. They list who spent money, pro and con. They give all the editorial.
Well, would you look at that?
This is nonpartisan and really good.
How to be Wikipedia.
Yeah, it's Wikipedia for voting. And I just wish everybody who's voting on Tuesday.
Well,
we live in a time where there's literally no excuse. There are very few good excuses. If you're a baby,
right.
I get it. If you're deceased, I get it.
But
if
you know
you're
what
a
happens.
Felon in a couple of
I'll
states,
give you an example.
But in general,
I'll give you an example. In
your
California,
excuse sucks.
California, if you read the voter's ballot, there's a proposition, Proposition 34.
Ooh, 34.
It's called death penalty in the ballot. And you vote yes or no.
Right.
Now, what do you think a yes vote does?
That you're for the death penalty.
No.
No, you're not, or exactly. Yes, you're not.
You're saying you're voting yes to repeal the death penalty, but on the ballot, it says Proposition 34, Death Penalty Initiative, yes or no. What do you vote?
So if you wait till you go to the ballot booth to decide what you're going to do,
it's too late. You screwed up.
Yeah.
Leo, this is the exact problem I have with all of these everybody needs to vote initiatives, and I love you, Baratunde. Please don't be mad at me.
I agree.
It screwed up California royally. I agree with you.
Say that again.
A side effect of that is you get uneducated voters out there.
By
the way, when I say don't vote, I mean don't vote for either of the two major parties. They're totally...
Yes, but if no one voted for the two major parties, but three people voted... Someone would win.
And that's still important to vote. Even if you live in a non-swing state, you want to keep voting so it doesn't become a swing state.
Yes.
Because that's annoying.
You get hit with all these ads. Because it comes down to right now, Ohio decides who the president of the United States is every single time.
Which is why if you're not in Ohio, you should vote for some third party, any third party, because your vote matters thousands of times more.
This is why I love you. That is a principled and reasonable and like sensical thing to say. And I will vote the way I want to, which is probably not the way you would. But we're participating, and that makes a whole ton of sense.
It's so funny that the libertarian Brian Brushwood is advocating government by fiat instead of democracy.
I don't know what that means. It sounds very intelligent.
I didn't hear that at all. What I heard is someone saying participate in the democratic process.
No, okay. So what I'm saying is first of all, we have a problem. The problem is our two-party system. That's one party more than the communists had, and that didn't work out so well for them.
You hate freedom, don't you? We now have them in collusion.
Run the debates together. They decide what is and isn't off the table.
Oh, here you go. Here's a headline on the New York Times. Democrats sue to extend Florida's voting early. So here we are again, back as we were 8 years ago.
Florida did. They decided they used to have this great system.
Yeah, a lot of states have basically restricted your ability to vote this time around.
Right. And it's mainly because poor working class voters can't make it to the polls on Tuesday.
Yeah, correct. They do. Big,
and so by doing so, they disenfranchise.
There's a whole movement called Why Tuesday, which challenges why we even force this to happen on a Tuesday.
Give us a month.
And if any truly freedom loving entity, party, person, whatever. Once maximum participation, it makes the system more legitimate. So
and
if you're fighting to reduce participation,
electrical college,
you're on the wrong side of history.
Because thanks to electricity, Tesla.
My point is your excuse sucks.
So can I
yourexcusesucks.com.
That's
all I have to say.
I'm going to let you guys take over. Go ahead and then I'll come back and do an ad.
We're going to take over. I'm actually going to make a request that people out there go and not only vote but also go and donate to the Red Cross or something like that for Hurricane Sandy.
$50 iTunes, let me just push a button.
There you go.
That's the easiest one. iTunes is great.
It was great. I just pushed a button. They didn't even have to give them any money.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
You gave money.
They have your money already.
They have your money.
You know what really works? Apple actually has all your money.
Yes.
And when you spend it elsewhere, you have a license to use the money that Apple's holding in escrow in your behalf.
Exactly.
Did you know
they already got it?
They have all of the money.
Apple, the amount of money that Apple has in the bank is $17.50 for every human being on planet Earth.
Wow. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this travel back through time. I want to thank Chad Johnson for editing all that together. That was a lot of work. And for all of you who went to twit.tv/best of to suggest moments from the past year of Twit. We've got best ofs for a number of our other shows, including Mac Break Weekly and Twig. But can I invite you, as you watch the shows throughout 2013, we're going to keep that page up. And anytime you see something, gee, that really ought to be in the year ender, go to twit.tv/best of and you can make a note of it. I think it's almost time for the 8-bit fire to... I didn't see those toes. I think it's time for the 8-bit fire to wrap up in a moment. So maybe I better wrap this up. I just want to thank you so much for your support throughout 2012. One of the biggest joys and pleasures of doing Twit and all of our shows, you see, I got to go now, the fireplace ended, is the community that surrounds it and the support you've given us, helping us build this beautiful studio every day in the chat room, the emails, the donations. It's very gratifying personally to me, and I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I really am so grateful to all of you for supporting what we do here at Twit. I'm following my bliss, and without your help, I couldn't do it. So thank you very much. I hope you have a wonderful new year. Stay safe. Don't get out on the road after tippling a little bit, all right? Just take care of yourself. We want you all back next year for many more episodes of This Week in Tech to come. Happy holidays to you all. Safe and sane New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. And I'll see you in 2015. Amazing. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining us. Another Twit. Laporte.